Blog Talk Radio.
On April 19, 1995, as many people were starting their workday, a beautiful spring morning in the heartland became chaos when at 9:02 a.m., explosions tore through the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building in downtown Oklahoma City.
An explosion at 9 o'clock this morning that did that damage you're looking at right there, blowing off the entire north face of that building.
The federal building located 200 North West 5th Street was almost completely destroyed.
A terrible tragedy has occurred here in Oklahoma City.
The bombing in Oklahoma City was an attack on innocent children and defenseless citizens.
168 people were killed in the blast and over 800 wounded. The hospitals were overrun with casualties. A rescue worker was killed from falling debris within the first few hours. But what would sear the bombing in the hearts of Americans was the 19 children inside the daycare center in the building who had lost their lives.
The most beautiful memorial left by anyone is not in the rubble of this building, but in the hearts and the lives that knew them and loved them. We come today to remember their lives, and we come today to offer thanks. Thanks for the hundreds and hundreds of people who were involved in the rescue and recovery efforts.
6 years before 9/11, it was the first mass casualty terrorist attack on American soil. The prologue to a new chapter in American history had been written in blood, fear, and shock. Terrorism had struck home. From now on, nothing would be the same again.
We know that more than McVeigh and Nichols were involved.
There were questions of other bombs being found at the scene of the crime, witnesses to the bombing.
The FBI, like any government agency, is more concerned with power, prestige, maintaining its position, rather than truth and justice.
Based on the damage pattern to the building, we
what the government says is impossible.
That life we had back before the bombing, that life is over.
For the first time in my fight with the government, they stepped forward and said it would pose a grave risk to the national security of the United States of America if we release these CIA documents.
If you know the truth will set you free.
You've got to band together, or it's over for all of us. The man on top will get you.
If we don't expose the fact that Oklahoma City stinks to high heaven, the same people that carried it out are going to do it over and over and over again, and they're going to use these frightening events to drive a stake through the United States and kill our republic.
Almost immediately, the Oklahoma City Police Department announced a be-on-the-lookout alert for two Middle Eastern-looking suspects wearing blue jogging suits. Shortly before the bombing, they were seen by a witness running from the Murrah Building and getting into a brown pickup truck, then driving away from the scene of the crime. It was soon determined that a truck bomb had exploded directly outside the building. Approximately 200 feet from the bomb crater, a VIN number stamped on a twisted axle identified the vehicle as a Ryder rental truck.
Two suspects are in custody this evening in the bombing of Oklahoma City's Murrah Federal Building.
Shortly after the bombing, a 26-year-old U.S. Army veteran, Timothy McVeigh, was pulled over by an Oklahoma Highway Patrol officer 60 miles north of Oklahoma City. He was stopped for speeding in his car without a license plate. McVeigh would admit to carrying a concealed handgun and was taken into custody without incident. It was the first time Timothy McVeigh had been arrested in his life. The original alert for two Middle Eastern males had been rescinded within hours of the bombing, and the identification number on the Ryder axle was traced to a rental agency in Kansas. The renter had given a false name, but had listed his address as a farmhouse in Michigan belonging to James Nichols. James's brother, Terry Nichols, was a friend of Tim McVeigh from their time in the U.S. Army. Upon hearing the news that he was wanted for questioning in the bombing, Terry Nichols turned himself in to the Harrington, Kansas Police Department. Within 24 hours after the attack, the FBI had received a tip from a former co-worker of Tim McVeigh in Buffalo, New York. The tipster informed the FBI that McVeigh had often espoused militant anti-government views and that McVeigh was very angry over the siege of the Branch Davidians by federal agents in Waco, Texas, which had ended in a catastrophic fire 2 years to the day before the Oklahoma City bombing.
That Friday, they showed the FBI bringing Tim McVeigh out of the jail in Perry, Oklahoma. And that's when I got angry, when I saw that it was an American and it was a Middle Easterner. I had a hard time accepting the fact that that Americans would do that. Americans are supposed to love their children. They are not supposed to murder their children.
Shaken, disillusioned, angered that that could happen in this country.
Upon learning that McVeigh was already in jail, the FBI transferred him to federal custody and an indictment was issued against Tim McVeigh, Terry Nichols, and others unknown for the bombing of the Murrah Federal Building. Another Army buddy of McVeigh's, Michael Fortier of Kingman, Arizona, was later arrested and charged with having advanced knowledge of the bombing plot.
The last thing I remember was being thrown to the center of that room and looking up and looking into the sky, and there was no roof and everything was just suspended up in the air in the sky.
When I came to, I stood up, I was facing the south, but all the light was behind me. And I turned, look back to the north, and the whole front of the building's gone. I'm about 4 to 5 feet from where it dropped off.
On the morning of April the 19th, 95, my dog, Gunny, and I arrived at the scene of the Murrah Building. There was a great deal of chaos at the scene. A lot of people bleeding, screaming, running away from the building.
I lost my two grandchildren. They were in the daycare center at the Murrah Building. Their names were Aaron and Elijah Coverdale. Aaron was 5 years old, Elijah was two. I was living at the Regency when the bombing happened. That morning I was at work. I had custody of Aaron and Elijah, so they lived with me. And I had dropped them off at the daycare center that Wednesday morning. I'd get up in the middle of the night and get in the shower and turn the water on so people wouldn't hear me screaming. And I'd just scream at God and ask him what was wrong. Why were we being punished so?
I knew the Coverdale boys, Elijah and Aaron. These two boys, they were characters. Me being single and living in this apartment, I was kind of a party guy at that time, 27 years old. At one point in time, I had promised these two boys that I was going to give them some toys. And problem with that, living in the Regency, you know, on the 18th floor, you leave something in your car, you don't want to go back down and get it because it's just a hassle unless it's ice cream. And so I left these toys in the car for the longest time. I never did get them, those toys, until, you know, after they passed away when I gave them to Janie.
Well, then I got watching the stuff down on the street, kind of got mesmerized by what was going on down on the street. While I was standing up there, there was a little girl that was taking a photography class at UCO that took a picture of the building, and I was in that picture.
You could not see anything in front of you. It was so, the smoke was so thick and so black. And the only thing I can tell you is it smelled like sulfur. If you were in a chemistry lab, it smelled like sulfur. And she said, you can't go that way. And I said, why? She said, there is nothing out there. It's gone.
The reasons for the bombing, the perpetrators, the rumors, and the suspects change depending on whose viewpoint you take. Like all controversial events, some of those closest to the event and farthest away are bound together by their questioning of the official story. The first questions were directed at the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, which had launched the raid on the Branch Davidians. The Oklahoma City office for the ATF was located in the Murrah Building and was the supposed target of the attack. Yet, no agents were killed or seriously wounded. Was the ATF office empty that morning?
I asked him if I could speak with an ATF officer that worked in the building so I could find out if they knew anything about my wife. And he told me that they were in debriefing. And I asked him, you know, I need to talk to one of them. I need to find out something. And he said that none of them had been in the building, so they weren't hurt. They'd been tipped by their pagers that morning not to come into work.
The ATF told several different stories to explain their agent's curious absence. The most fantastic story was that two agents were indeed inside the building and were heroes that day. ATF agent Luke Franey claimed that he was knocked unconscious by the blast and, after an aborted helicopter rescue, crawled onto an outside ledge to escape his office. Franey reported that he then used his martial arts skills to break through several walls and injured his hand. Another agent, Alex McCauley, claimed that he was in an elevator at the time of the bombing. After free-falling for five floors, McCauley supposedly broke out and rescued several people.
My crews were the crews working on the Murrah Building the day of the bombing. Immediately after the bombing, they called me on the radios, and at that point, they were going in to assist with, because the fire department hadn't even got there yet, they were going to check to make sure all the elevators were clear. They weren't aware, because they were coming from the south side, that the building on the north side was gone. So they went in to check the elevators, and that's when they found out how bad the damage was inside the building. None of the elevators went to free fall because the governor overspeeds were not tripped. The safety mechanisms on the bottom of the elevators were not tripped, so none of the elevators had a free fall condition. I think it was McCauley indicated that they were trapped in an elevator. So at the grand jury investigation, once I got the FEMA report that showed which elevator they were in, I said that there's no possible way they could have been in that elevator because my men checked it and it was still locked from the top, and the doors were, the wall had caved in against the doors between floors, so they couldn't have gotten out of the elevator without assistance.
Jane Graham worked in the building for over a decade, was vice president of the Federal Employees Union, Ann has testified before Congress on labor issues. She knew everyone in the building and bore witness to suspicious behavior that morning.
On the morning of the bombing, when my husband dropped me off and I got out of the car, as I was walking toward the entrance, there were two men standing directly in front of the double doors, and there was a little sitting area there, planter and so forth there in front. They were standing right there on the sidewalk. They had on ATF jackets, which said ATF on them. They were talking to a third gentleman who was dressed in business clothes. And I saw them, their backs were to me, and I thought, they don't normally, you know, all the people we see go up there to ATF, they're never identifiable. You know, they always are dressed, you know, a lot of them look like drug people and other things, and, you know, but they're certainly not dressed for you to be able to tell who they are.
A paramedic who responded to the bombing, Tiffany Bible, confirms that the ATF were not in their office and, in fact, may have been aware of some type of threat that day. In this affidavit, she states that immediately after the bombing, she asked an ATF agent on the scene if any of them were in the building. He responded, "No, we weren't in there today," and that the Murrah building was bombed because of Waco. She further states that within the first 20 minutes of the bombing, she saw at least 8 ATF agents outside the building in clean black jumpsuits. To this day, the ATF has been unwilling to address their prior knowledge of the bombing. Beyond the vague rumors of the significance of April 19th, some federal agencies were aware of an actual threat.
One of the most frustrating things about prior knowledge is that the media, some in the media and others, would accuse us of saying that the government blew the building up, which we never said, and I do not believe.
The U.S. Marshals, responsible for security of federal personnel and facilities, warned that, quote, "Islamic terrorists may be planning suicide attacks against federal courthouses and government installations, designed to attract worldwide press attention through the murder of innocent victims." The ATF had placed informant Carol Howell into a white separatist community in eastern Oklahoma called Elohim City. Another ATF agent admitted under oath that one suspect, Andy Strassmeyer, was reported to make, quote, "threats to blow up federal buildings," unquote, before the Oklahoma City bombing. Furthermore, Carol Howell actually drove Strassmeyer and other suspects to Oklahoma City to scout bombing targets. Was this the source of the ATF's suspicious behavior the morning of April 19th? U.S. Representative Ernest Istook of Oklahoma also displayed advanced knowledge of the bombing.
To my left from the east, I saw Senator Istook kind of work his way west. Well, he came up to me and we started talking small talk, you know, terrible thing and all this, and really didn't know what much to say. And he said, he made the comment, "Yeah, we knew this was going to happen."
I noticed the lady back behind me by a backhoe, they're taking pictures. She identified herself as an attorney, Lana Tyree, and she was with Ernest Istook. And she made a comment to me that Istook told her that they were aware of a bomb threat since April 9th. You didn't really think much about it until this grand jury and stuff started probing into it, and people were claiming that there wasn't any prior knowledge. You know, I started thinking about it and got with Dave, and we put two and two together, and we said, "Hey, somebody knew about a prior bomb threat. You know, this ought to be known."
"Everyone who knows me knows I would not sit idle if I knew about a conspiracy of silence. I would never rest until such a conspiracy was exposed. But I know of no such conspiracy."
Istook has denied this evidence under oath, but he has never answered the Oklahoma County Sheriff's deputy's challenge to subject his opposing versions of prior knowledge to polygraph testing. Many witnesses have officially stated that the Oklahoma County Bomb Squad was conducting a search at the federal courthouse across the street from the Murrah building 2 hours before the attack.
Trish Nix, I ran into her. She was another employee there at HUD, and she had asked me if I had seen the Bomb Squad that morning. And I had said no, I wasn't aware that they had been in the building. And she said yes, she had seen their unit parked in the parking lot of the church across the street.
County Appraiser J.D. Reed saw the bomb disposal unit parked outside the courthouse that morning. Despite multiple eyewitnesses, the Sheriff's Department denies this claim.
If that building was under threat and they were getting bomb threats, and this was a daily thing or a weekly thing, or if they've gotten many threats or only one, the parents of the children in that daycare deserve to have been notified. People do not keep children in daycares where there are bomb threats made.
Under the pressure of mounting evidence, ABC's 2020 reported on many of these puzzling questions a year and a half after the bombing.
At issue increasingly for some of the victims and their families, what did authorities know or suspect before the explosion that federal workers and the children arriving at the Murrow Building did not know or were not told?
There was this fairly large truck with a trailer behind it, and it had a shield on the side of the door, and it said bomb disposal or bomb squad below it.
Authorities now claim in federal investigative reports that the huge, ominous truck with its trailer was being used by a deputy to run routine errands. Other documents obtained by 2020 show that someone called the executive secretariat's office at the Justice Department in Washington and said the Murrow Building had been bombed. But this was 24 minutes before the blast. No action was apparently taken.
According to the show's producer, the Justice Department actively intervened to prevent an in-depth follow-up to this segment from airing nationally.
2020 did a 15 or 20 minute segment on prior knowledge that was put together by a guy named Roger Charles. That was so explosive that he was putting together an entire hour or whatever for 2020, which he would tell you. But the feds came in and stopped 2020, wouldn't let them broadcast the larger segment that he put together concerning prior knowledge.
The news channel has learned of another strange development. Apparently, before the bombing, Governor Frank Keating's brother, Mark, had been working on a novel about a terrorist bombing in Oklahoma City. Stranger still, one of the characters in the novel was named Thomas McVeigh.
Despite the official denials, the evidence confirms that at least some amount of prior knowledge existed. More ominously, there are suggestions that certain government agencies were fully expecting a bombing to occur that day.
The Horse Patrol, interestingly, was a very small unit and was assisted by the county reserve mounted patrol unit. For whatever reason, on the morning of the bombing, they had been assigned and had already met at the Oklahoma City Equine Canine Facility and had prepared their horses, their tack, and uniforms to go downtown for crowd control. Rarely, very rarely would they go down and patrol or work downtown area for crowd control for anything.
The importance of exposing prior knowledge cannot be understated. Those individuals who understood the danger beforehand and did nothing are just as guilty as those who lit the fuse on the bomb. As the FBI and Department of Justice narrowed its focus on Tim McVeigh as the lone bomber on April 19th, people seeking truth and justice for the dead were dismayed that so many reports of accomplices were being discarded by the federal authorities. The first sketches of the suspects released by the FBI clearly indicated that two people were involved in parking the Ryder truck in front of the Murrah Building, and the original BOLA, or Be on the Lookout Alert, had mentioned three suspects. When the hunt for John Doe number 2 was called off and he was dismissed as a ghost, people who knew for a fact that they had seen McVeigh with other people began to speak out. Did McVeigh act alone?
During that time, broadcasts were being made that there was suspects had been observed leaving the scene in a brown pickup.
At this time, people were trying to get together on who was going to do what. Medical personnel and such. There was a police car sitting to my left, facing west, on 5th Street. And as we were all standing there conversing and, you know, people were doing what they were doing, it came out over the radio on this police car that they were looking for a brown truck, an APB for a brown truck. It was quick, but it was heard.
I haven't stopped asking questions because I know that we haven't been told the truth. I've talked to too many people that saw Timothy McVeigh that morning. Saw Timothy McVeigh in Kansas and saw Timothy McVeigh in Oklahoma City. Not one person saw him by himself.
Timothy McVeigh stepped out of the truck. I walked him over to, let's say, 10, 11 feet away from the truck itself. I pointed a direction downtown, which is to my right. He seemed to acknowledge where I was talking about. At that time, the gentleman walked back to the truck. I talked to him. I also noticed there was a passenger in the truck at that time.
And mostly, it was a John Doe 2 thing, because as you remember, it's the greatest manhunt there's ever been. And then all of a sudden, hey, he doesn't even exist. If he doesn't exist, what was the deal about the manhunt? I mean, things like that. That was continually coming out.
I know for a fact Timothy McVeigh was with another individual on the morning of April 19th, right before the bombing.
Because the evidence is overwhelming and compelling that there were other perpetrators, and they were not pursued in the very early days after the bombing. The decision was made not to pursue any more of those individuals.
In the days before the bombing, Tim McVeigh was seen making preparations with other suspects, not Terry Nichols or Michael Fortier, but others unknown whom the authorities seemed uninterested in finding.
Yeah, the man that I saw on the phone that day that was actually on the phone was McVeigh. I am 100% sure of that. He had a partner with him that had shoulder-length hair that was leaned up against the wall facing him. Then at one point, he turned to the guy to his right who was leaning against the wall, shoulder-length hair, and said, he told us to stay here. I did go up to the FBI at 50 Penn Place and told them my story. If I remember right, I think they actually sketched out the second person that I was describing, which was shoulder-length hair, tan, stocky build, a light plaid-type jacket, shirt kind of mix, kind of goofy-looking guy.
A convenience store clerk reported to the FBI that McVeigh had purchased fuel for a Ryder truck at her store 2 days before the bombing, even pointing out on the register tape when the purchase was made. Accompanying McVeigh was another suspect. This example is only one of many eyewitness accounts that diverge from the official narrative. And although the government states that McVeigh never scouted inside the Murrah building, a Secret Service investigator reported that she had seen him in the building also with a second suspect. The official narrative dictates that Tim McVeigh alone rented the Ryder truck in Junction City, Kansas on April 17, 2 days before the bombing. He and Terry Nichols supposedly constructed the bomb on April 18. But the bulk of eyewitness accounts assert that the Ryder truck was at Geary Lake for several days before that.
I retired April 11, 1995, and after finishing up that morning, I decided to stop by here and fish at Geary State Lake, which is right in this general area here that I was fishing from, the pier or jetty. And I stayed here most of the afternoon fishing, of course, with no luck. And later on that afternoon, I had decided to maybe go back over this way over here to the other point back there and see if I'd have any luck. When I noticed a Ryder truck over there, I was sitting at home one day and my wife came in from work and she said that she had been stopped in a roadblock up here at Geary Lake in reference to the Oklahoma City bombing and the making of the bomb here at Geary State Lake and with a Ryder truck. And I said, well, you know, I had told you about the Ryder truck I had seen there before this. And that's how I became aware of it. And then the next thing I knew, she told the ATF and FBI, the people at the roadblock, that what I had seen. And before I knew it, my house was swarming with agents.
McVeigh stayed at the Dreamland Motel just outside the gates of Fort Riley, Kansas, while he rented the truck and built the bomb. Once again, eyewitnesses state that he was not alone, and the Ryder truck was there for days before the FBI insists it was. The maid at the Dreamland saw McVeigh's friend with the Ryder truck and when shown a sketch of John Doe number 2, told the FBI, "My God, who did the sketch? It looks just like him." All these reports indicate that more than one Ryder truck was involved in the bombing, and more people than the government is letting on.
Justice for these killers will be certain, swift, and severe. We will find them, we will convict them, and we will seek the death penalty for them.
It was promised to the people of Oklahoma City and to the rest of America that every single person responsible for the bombing would be caught, tried, and held accountable for the harm they had inflicted. It was expected that this promise would be fulfilled. Nevertheless, as eyewitness testimony and other promising leads were being carelessly discarded, replaced only with the lies and inconsistencies of federal officials, a deep but private suspicion grew in the minds of observers that perhaps a government cover-up was underway. Was this mere incompetence, or was there something else at work here?
I was a police officer in the Tulsa Police Department for 27 years. And in 1995, when the Oklahoma City bombing occurred, I was requested by the local FBI office through our chief of police to assist any way I could and look into the bombing, and using my contacts as an investigative journalist, which is what I did on the side, to try to find out anything we could find out about the bombing, McVeigh, Nichols, and just kind of follow the investigation any place it went, just follow the leads. I was still working the case with Janie Davis and David Hoffman, two Oklahoma City police officers, and one of them, it was one of the first ones in the building, and he saw some things in the building. He saw the biggest damage to the building was the pit, which was in the back of the building and went down like two or three floors. He saw all of that, you know. That never came out in the news. It wasn't part of the investigation. It didn't count. In other words, if it didn't fit the mold that the Department of Justice under Janet Reno set for the FBI, then it wasn't put in the case, period.
The FBI bragged about its handling of the deadliest terror attack in American history, but gigantic holes in the case were being ignored by the media. McVeigh was first suspected because he rented the truck under the name Robert Kling. One of the first pieces of evidence used to link McVeigh to the bombing was problematic.
Yeah, I went to Junction City. I went out to Elliott's body shop, and I spoke to Mr. Elliott. I told him who I was, and I said, I would like for you to tell me what happened the day Tim came to rent the Ryder truck. And he said, "You mean the day Tim and his friend came?" And I said, "Tim wasn't by himself?" He said, "No, ma'am."
The FBI has been designated by President Clinton as the lead federal agency in this investigation.
Incredibly enough, there remains an extra unidentified leg that was found in the rubble. Oklahoma State Medical Examiner Fred Jordan testified in court, "We had 8 people with traumatically amputated left legs. However, we have 9 left legs. We have 1 leg too many." Stephen Jones, McVeigh's defense attorney, detailed in his book, Others Unknown, the significance of this extra leg. Former chief pathologist for Northern Ireland, T.K. Marshall, performed over 2,500 autopsies on bombing victims and told Jones that, "In all the years in Ireland, we identified every innocent person that was killed. There was never an unknown victim." The FBI collected 1,034 fingerprints during their investigation, but an agent admitted under oath that these prints were not run through the National Fingerprint Database. Nikki Deutschman was the jury foreperson for the federal trial of Terry Nichols.
I think that the government perhaps really dropped the ball. I think that there were a large number of sightings right around before the week before and the days and months after the bombing, and sketches of people that were recognizable. In this trial, there even was a photograph of someone who may have been involved with mixing the bomb, with putting the bomb together. And that person, it was a photograph from a newspaper. Obviously, that person's identity is known. I think there are other people out there, and decisions were probably made very early on that Tim McVeigh and Terry Nichols were who they were looking for, and the same sort of resources were not used to try to find out who else might be involved.
Well, in those first couple of days, especially that first day of the Oklahoma City bombing, there was immediate information that came out about what caused the bombing, witnesses on the scene of the crime, things such as that. And it changed very significantly and drastically as the day went by and the next several days went by. That caused a lot of questions in people's minds about, well, what really happened here?
The reason I started doubting the official story that was coming out, you have to understand that the state, the local media were doing a good job the first day. Local law enforcement maybe also, I believe, was doing a good job. But once the feds came in, things started changing.
The police and emergency crews are talking about moving us back because of the danger of a possibility of another explosion.
I think you said another bomb. Another bomb, move
back. Oh my God, another bomb.
The fire crews and the various emergency crews are trying to get in, but we keep getting reports that there may be other devices in the area.
They will use that trailer. You see the bucket on the back there, sort of this is how they would transport the explosive device away from this populated area to try to do something with it.
There were two unexploded devices discovered subsequent to the initial explosion.
A second bomb was found on the east side of that building. A bomb squad is on the scene. That second bomb has not exploded. We don't know quite the status yet, if they've managed to defuse it, but it has been confirmed.
There have been reports of two explosive devices, unexploded explosive devices.
Two different explosive devices were found in addition to the one that went off.
Just an hour after the initial explosion, downtown Oklahoma City was shaken up again with word of another bomb, or maybe two.
They've had to back off a couple times because they found, I guess, two or three other bombs, or at least explosive devices down there that they've had to defuse.
They shut down our operation for about 20, 30 minutes because of that, and that was very frustrating because we were right at the point where we had people and we had to leave them.
The first bomb that was in the federal building did go off. It did the damage that you see right there. The second explosive was found and defused.
The Oklahoma City bombing was one of the first big stories that I covered, and it was just shocking to know it was an inside job and to know that the media was involved in the cover-up and that the mainstream television stations there in Oklahoma City knew what had really happened. And then years later, I was able to actually talk to some of those reporters, and they discussed how they were told to shut up. I mean, it just showed how people were so willing to be part of the cover-up just because the truth was so frightening. And that's really why we've become so enslaved, is that we just give in to the lies, and they start little, but they get bigger and bigger.
It's amazing when everyone who can see an event, and that gets changed into something else, simply because the media presents it that way. That means the media is complicit in the cover-up. They're not hapless. They're not ignorant. How come I can figure this out and CNN can't?
The controlled corporate mainstream media is essential to a cover-up like Oklahoma City being successful. And that's why the mainstream media has lost so much credibility. Because all over the nation, people have seen things like Oklahoma City over and over again, where you see the live footage. You see them removing the bombs. You see the governor admitting it. And then later the media says, we never said that. That's what conspiracy theorists say.
At first, the media reported on some of these bothersome pieces of evidence, but they became little more than parrots for the Justice Department as the official story was railroaded into the public mind.
I've been listening to Mike McCurry, President Clinton's spokesperson at the White House. Apparently, at this point, we know a little bit more than the White House does, because we have been able to confirm that it was a car explosion. Now, that word coming to us from Mayor Ron Norick earlier, 1,200 pounds of explosives parked out in front of a federal building.
And ATF has confirmed that as well.
Who's going to investigate the investigators? Who's going to investigate the prosecutors? Who's going to hold them accountable? Who's going to hold us public officials accountable? And that's all we're trying to do here, in addition to trying to find the truth.
Well, initially that morning, all the media that was downtown there reporting were reporting the truth. They reported the truth about the unexploded bombs, undetonated bombs being removed from the building. By afternoon, things began to ease a little bit. You could sense a difference, and by the next day, everybody but Channel 4 had changed their story completely.
One local station in Oklahoma City, KFOR-TV, did perform its duty by reporting on McVeigh's accomplices, the evidence of prior warnings, and many other aspects of the case. The New York Times Broadcasting Company purchased KFOR a year after the bombing. The programming director was fired, the lead journalist on the bombing, Jana Davis, was let go, and all reporting that contradicted the government vanished. The victims turned to the government with their questions, expecting the full truth to come out. This was not to be. Those who asked too many questions or knew too much were discouraged from their efforts in other ways.
Debbie Nakanashi, who was with the post office, she was told not to talk to anybody about that. Her job had been threatened to her. She went to the union over it. Then they apologized. But she and I went on a number of occasions to Washington, D.C. We tried to see every senator and every congressman from Oklahoma. Not one would give us an interview.
I was told by an FBI agent, that due to comments that I'd made, that people like me often ended up dead, and he'd be careful what I said if I was him. And in the way that he put it forth, I felt like it was a threat.
I wrote letters to Janet Reno when she was the United States Attorney General. I wrote Louis Free, who was over the FBI at that time. I wrote Senator Orrin Hatch. I wrote everybody I could think of asking for help. Nothing was done.
When the government decided that the investigation was over, a federal grand jury was impaneled to hand down indictments. This is usually a straightforward process. But the federal prosecutors were not counting on one grand juror, Hoppe Heidelberg, to actually ask questions of his own.
My name is Hoppe Heidelberg, and I served on the federal grand jury that was supposed to investigate the Mirabilan bombing in Oklahoma City back in 1995. Actually, the grand jury has two responsibilities that are outlined in this book. The first one says the grand jury operates as a sword, authorizing the government's prosecution of suspected criminals, and also as a shield, protecting citizens from unwarranted or inappropriate prosecutions. Now, that's not something that the media or the government ever points out, but that was actually the reason for a grand jury in the first place, to protect citizens from the Crown, who at the time had a habit of prosecuting their political enemies or anybody they chose for any reason. The grand jury, our grand jury, that was supposed to be calling witnesses, were not allowed to call any. And it was my letter to the judge telling him that and demanding that we be allowed to call witnesses that got me excused from the grand jury. What you will hear and what they say that's a lie is that the grand jury foreman is the only one that has the right to do this or that. And that's not true. According to the book, any member can demand anything he wants for any reason. It can be just his personal opinion. It can be from information he gets. And of course, they tell us, well, you can't watch TV or you can't read the paper. That's nonsense. That's nonsense. Grand jurors need to be well informed if they're going to do their job properly. See, we were never allowed to see the photo evidence from the cameras on the Murrah building that would have shown the truck being parked and the people who got out of the truck. That's all on tape. And we were authorized to see all of that, but we weren't allowed to see it. And in fact, nobody's been allowed to see it. All those tapes have been kept under wraps for 15 years. It was just too important, to the American people to know what happened there for me to keep quiet, because nobody else was going to speak up. The other grand jurors were petrified because they observed on a daily basis the kind of intimidation tactics that were used by the Department of Justice attorneys to tempt to keep me under control. And when they found out about the FBI visits to my home, I really shook them up. Now they're even scared to talk to me in the men's room.
Hoppe will never be silenced. In 1998, he ran as an independent candidate for governor of Oklahoma, intent on reopening the investigation into the bombing. After being excluded from the gubernatorial debate, Hoppe walked on stage to ask Governor Frank Keating why.
Y'all both are on record as saying that you think I should participate. Do you still believe that?
Come on, Hoppe.
Thank you, audience. Mr. Jenkins, your follow-up now.
Two years after the bombing, the trial of Tim McVeigh began in Denver, Colorado. The trial had been moved out of Oklahoma despite the constitutional mandate that federal crimes must be tried in the district in which they occurred. The truth seekers were assured that all of their questions would be answered in court.
The trial was not handled appropriately. It was handled in a way that was very prejudiced against the defendants. If you look at what Judge Mache did concerning prejudicing the jury toward the people that were being prosecuted, by 2 weeks he showed them pictures of dead babies and blood and guts, and which is all basically, in my understanding of the law, illegal to prejudice the jury like that. Yet they did that kind of stuff apparently on purpose.
I was told that by the U.S. attorney that if I attended the trials in Denver, that all of my questions would be answered. I gave up everything I had, my apartment and everything, and I moved to Denver. And I attended both trials, and by the time Terry Nichols' trial was over, I had more questions and no answers.
The trial lasted 3 weeks. In contrast, the O.J. Simpson trial in 1995 had lasted 9 months. The jury deliberated for less than 24 hours and sentenced Tim McVeigh to death. McVeigh waived all his appeals and was fast-tracked to be the first federal prisoner executed in decades. Just before his execution date, the FBI announced that they had withheld thousands of pages of documents that could have influenced his trial, which led to a month-long stay of execution.
I mean, they weren't able to get thousands, at least thousands, probably a lot more than that, of documents from, you know, the FBI and the DOJ. They just wouldn't turn them over.
On June 11, 2001, Tim McVeigh was put to death by lethal injection at the federal death row in Terre Haute, Indiana. He left no message and was quickly cremated without an autopsy being performed on his body, contrary to the standard procedure for executed prisoners. Terry Nichols was tried and found guilty in a separate trial and received a life sentence without the possibility of parole. In 2004, Terry Nichols was then tried in Oklahoma on state murder charges in the prosecutor's hope of imposing a death sentence. Nichols was found guilty, but a jury once again refused to execute him.
Those jurors did the best job they could with the case that was presented to them. I think what their statement says is they knew there was something wrong and somebody had some involvement here. They also, as they have said themselves, that there were lies, there were mistruths, there were bungling, there was arrogance, there was things that were not pursued like the other John Does, and so they felt like there was a reasonable doubt.
Michael Fortier became a witness for the federal prosecutors, received a 10-year sentence, and was released in 2006 directly into the Witness Protection Program. Justice, the government announced, had been served.
And I know tomorrow.
Hey, my dad's good. Don't leave her.
As the government proclaimed justice for all impacted by the bombing, the people back in Oklahoma still sought the truth and knew now they were on their own. The list of questions continued to grow due to the mysterious death of Oklahoma City Police Officer Sergeant Terrence Yakey. Terry Yakey, unlike the rest of Oklahoma, may have known too much. Officer Yakey was just over 30 years old at the time of the bombing. The morning of the bombing, he was issuing a traffic ticket near the Civic Center Music Hall, which is about four blocks to the west of where the Murray Building stood. He dropped the ticket book, let the woman go, and says, I have to obviously attend to other things. He heard the multiple blasts coming from the Murray Building, sped up there in his black and white squad car, and immediately started pulling out the first of eight people, Mr. Tom Hall being the first, a former employee of the GSA. Tom, to this day, in fact, I talked to him a couple of weeks ago, still has the utmost respect for Officer Yaki. He literally saved his life. Officer Yaki, being an astute police officer for 7 years, veteran of the Oklahoma City Police Department, knew that something was horribly wrong. He tried to get the official storyline out through his commanding officers at the Oklahoma City Police Department, through his family, through his ex-wife, and he chose to withhold some of the storyline because he was in fear of for his family and his wife and his two young daughters at the time. What we found out, between the hours of 8 a.m. and 1 p.m. that morning, he was brutally murdered a mile and a half from the front gate of the El Reno Penitentiary. From that moment that his body was found, we know that the crime scene was destroyed. There were spade shovels that were used to turn over the crime scene. Ballistics, any gunpowder residue, anything that had to do with his death was completely destroyed. It was corrupted.
He started having problems with not only at work, but his apartment got broke into, his car got broke into, things were stolen out of his house. He had accumulated reports, evidence, I don't know what at all, but he was going to take it out to a mini storage in El Reno. And he left one night, and he told a friend of his that they were going to go out to dinner. He says, I got to run out and put some stuff in mini storage. And as soon as I shake these feds that are following me, I'll be back and we'll go to dinner. Well, he never came back. Instead, he was found the next day by a Canadian County Sheriff's deputy. Well, they found his car first, and then they found him in a field near the El Reno Penitentiary. The damage to his body was obviously a torture homicide. It was obvious. But what intrigued me the most, that he had several cuts on both of his wrists, inside both elbows, both jugular veins. He'd been beaten. He had ligature marks around his neck. He had handcuff marks on his hands, on his wrists. And he had a small caliber bullet wound that started above on the right-hand side of his temple and exited low on his cheek with no powder burns.
The day of his death, when my daughter called me, I left work, went to El Reno to help because I could hear the seriousness in her voice that she was getting upset. Why would the police be calling her looking for Terrence? And when we went to the apartment where he lived, the manager there stated to us, well, why are you looking for him? The police have already been here and taken his cruiser. So I'm not sure what was going on. It was strange. And about 10 o'clock at night, I had put my grandkids to bed. The phone rang. And when I picked the phone up, I could hear my daughter screaming in the background. And I assumed something bad had happened. But I didn't think death. And my son said, Mom, they found Terry. He's dead.
One of the things that surprised me was that there was no autopsy performed. The other thing that really bothered me was we were being told that Terry was high on drugs and drunk. And of course, the medical examiner's office did a report on Terry and his injuries, which was really not an autopsy, but just an overview. And it showed that his BAC was zero, meaning no blood alcohol content. There was no drugs in his system. It bothered me that they didn't treat Terry like a police officer like he was. He was a good guy.
And he never said to us that I'm depressed. I'm, you know, I need help. Not to me or not to his sisters. I think it's only fair that we know, as Terrence's family members, what happened.
Officer Yaki's official cause of death was suicide. And that was actually laid out in the medical examiner's report at the Oklahoma State Medical Office, examiner's office. We've since were able to retrieve that record. What we found out, though, is that, number one, the crime scene was corrupted. went completely in the face of a proper investigative procedure. The extent and the amount of and the number of wounds on his body clearly shows that he couldn't commit suicide physically and logistically. You just can't do that to yourself. Terry also, we knew, was anemic. He would not have been able to traverse over half a mile from where his car was to where his body was found and not have passed out. His heart would have literally given out. He wouldn't have had enough blood pressure in his body to survive. The car was locked. The windows were rolled up. The keys were in the console. There was a bloody knife in the glove box. You don't stab yourself 13 times and have superficial wounds on the along your arms and chest and your upper neck and walk a half a mile and decide to die next to a tree.
Being the family of an officer, I expected some kind of care and consideration for us, being the family of Terrence. There was another detective by the name of Mullinex that told my daughter that she looked at too many movies and she needed to see a psychiatrist. When we were asking questions, wanting to know about his belongings, wanting to know about things that happened during the course of where they say they found my son. And I don't think this was very kind of them and considerate of us being family, that they should have talked to us like that. But they did. And as far as I'm concerned, that made me more suspicious of what happened to my son.
The brutal torture and murder of Terry Yagi served not only to silence his voice, but the voices of other first responders who may have seen something that would shed light on what really happened. Those who keep their silence know exactly what Terry saw, but he will never be forgotten by those who ask questions and demand answers. In the absence of official action, a group of concerned citizens decided to form their own investigative panel, the OKBIC, better known as the Oklahoma Bombing Investigation Committee. Their goal was to compile enough evidence that would attract attention by the media and the government, and therefore compel a more thorough investigation. Entirely funded by donations and their own money, the OKBIC took affidavits, recorded eyewitness testimony, and paid for private investigators to chase down leads.
I'm Charles Key, state representative in Oklahoma City, and I've formed the Oklahoma Bombing Investigation Committee. I had a number of constituents come to me and other people that started raising their own questions about the investigation, what direction it was going, because it seemed like there was an effort to try to change that initial report of what took place on the first day of the bombing as the days and weeks went by.
We look at what State Representative Charles Key did. He went on the facts. He went on the information the grand jury gleaned. And clearly there was complete prior knowledge.
I observed the fact that Charles Key seemed to be standing up for the truth in some areas that I felt like was not being dealt with appropriately by authorities. The Oklahoma Bombing Investigation Committee was formed for one purpose, and that's to obtain the truth.
First, I thought, that's just another politician trying to get a little publicity. Then when I met them, met Charles Key and Colonel Wallace and Dale Phillips, found out that they were for real, and they asked me if I would join them, and I agreed to join them.
I think Charles Key's work is absolutely outstanding, and it continues to be, even to this day. We're looking at, 16 years on almost, coming this April. Charles took a lot of risks.
When we saw what was going on with the investigation and that it was trying to move away from the early facts that were presented by law enforcement and by the media, we pursued establishing a county grand jury in Oklahoma County, something unique to Oklahoma and just a few other states in the country that allows citizens' grand juries to be impaneled to investigate things such as this.
The committee meetings were very serious. We fought the government at every level all the way through to the Supreme Court of the state.
We had a lot of people that came forward and brought us a lot of information that we wouldn't have gotten any other way. We were pursuing all the information that we could get our hands on about the bombing, and we were trying to get a congressional investigation of the bombing.
I was in awe at the amount of effort that they put in that first 6.5 years before the book was released. And then they had the book released, come out to the general public 3 weeks before 9/11 occurred. And to see every single obstacle that was thrown in their face, from all the way from the news media to financial to emotional, and interviewing over 329 victims, family members, and survivors. And these people were consistently basically saying, I am not going to fail. I'm not going to quit. I want the truth to come out on this.
So we formed the Oklahoma County Grand Jury to have essentially a citizen's investigation into the Oklahoma bombing. And that caused us to have to get together a number of signatures from citizens of Oklahoma County, which we did.
We got, I don't know, 11, 12,000 signatures. We only were required 5,000. And by getting all those signatures, getting them validated and everything, we then got X amount of money, a lot of money, and the opportunity to set up a grand jury. Well, they turned the grand jury over to our enemy, which was Bob Macy, and basically gave him the money, and then he proceeded to investigate us.
I wrote a letter to the district attorney, Macy, told him what I had seen and that I wanted to testify in the grand jury. I got a letter back from him telling me that the grand jury did not want to hear anything I had to say about the bombing.
After the Oklahoma County grand jury was actually initially formed, then there were some efforts to try to stop that by the Oklahoma County DA and others. And at that time, we organized ourselves in a more formal way. We hired private investigators and some others to help us put the information that we had gathered together in a form that we could present to that county grand jury.
4, 5, 6 months into the investigation, we started suspecting that our phones were tapped. And I don't remember how we got the information, but we were given a number that we could dial, and it would either confirm or that it were tapped or that they weren't. And we'd dial this number, it would confirm it. We didn't really have anything to hide, so it didn't really make that much difference. It didn't affect our investigation too much.
I think as we finalized our work, as we got to the end, as that grand jury was impaneled, and as we put this report together, we had a lot of media that was waiting for this report. They were ready to give it some significant coverage. And our report came back from the book publisher about 2 weeks before 9/11. And one of the things that we said and some others said during that time frame, as before and after 9/11, that the reason that we did this is because if you don't ask the questions and you don't hold government accountable in everything that it does, not just bombings like this, but everything, then you'll have the same mistakes happen again, and they will get worse as time goes on.
The official story dictated that the Ryder truck packed with 1,200 pounds of ammonium nitrate fertilizer and fuel oil, called ANFO, detonated on the northeast side of the building and was responsible for all the damage. That hypothesis later evolved into 4,800 pounds of ANFO, then up to 7,000 pounds of fertilizer and nitromethane? In fact, the only consistent theme of the official narrative is its inconsistency.
The truck bomb just delivers an air blast. That's all it does. It's called an air blast. And when you've got 8-foot thick columns of concrete filled with rebar the size of your arm, an air blast probably won't even break one. It break windows. That's about it. But some of these columns were ripped up, shredded, tossed around.
Because a truck bomb is going to release its energy simultaneously in every direction, and so the damage pattern to the building or whatever structure it's parked in front of and intended to blow up. If it's a big enough big structure, bigger than a truck bomb can take out, the damage pattern is going to be roughly a semicircle.
Now, I looked at the building. I was on a bomb squad for a couple of years. I've worked some bombings. And I looked at the building, and I knew that the damage done to that building couldn't have come from a truck with ANFO in it.
A blast does not turn corners. And it did look like that there was a secondary explosion or a more intense explosion towards the east side of the building. Explosion, or that portion of the explosion, did basically clear everything from the front of the building to the south wall.
The Oklahoma Bombing Investigation Committee was presented with evidence that explosives planted inside the building were responsible for the collapse and most of the casualties. In this rarely seen footage taken by the Oklahoma County Sheriff's Office minutes after the bombing, the north side parking lot is shown littered with paper and debris from inside the Murrah building. How did this volume of paper transport itself against the blast wave of the truck bomb and magically appear on the other side of the street?
And then we look at the fact that you have bombs clearly inside the building. It's blown out across the street, pieces of it on top of buildings, the opposite direction that the rubble should have gone in, if there was truly this high-powered truck bomb out front that caused all the damage.
And I can tell you that the building was blown from the inside because all the debris was piled up against the General Record building clear across the parking lot.
In fact, several witnesses report that bombs were going off in the building before the truck bomb exploded outside.
The first thing that I experienced, when I was sitting there signing some papers for Ruth, I felt the building start shaking, and never had anything like that happen before, and I just kind of froze. And then the lights went out. It didn't get totally dark because the whole front of the building was glass. The lights went out, and then the debris started falling on my desk. And then something hit me in the back of the head and knocked me out before the truck bomb went off. What that tells you is that there were other explosive devices in the building that actually brought the building down.
The building started to sway back and forth. It was going back and forth. And I had sat there, and I thought, no, it doesn't feel like an earthquake. And I was, I was kind of stunned. And then about 7 or 8 seconds later, I felt this explosion, and you could feel the concrete floor actually rising from underneath you. You could feel it coming up from the inside.
It was like slow motion. We crawled under before the glass started coming, and everything, it just seemed to roll in on us. I thought it was an earthquake when it started. It was just a kind of a shake, and then everything started going like this, and I dove under the desk, and then all the glass came in, and the ceilings came down. And
3 seismographs at the University of Oklahoma, the Omniplex Science Museum, and in Franklin, Oklahoma, recorded a seismic event lasting 8 to 10 seconds that suggests the possibility of 2 blasts. There were 2 energetic spikes. One was the truck bomb, and the second spike was explained away as air blasts pushing on the ground or falling debris. But a representative of the Oklahoma Geological Survey stated for the record that this spike was not the result of floors collapsing and that the last 5 seconds of ground motion did not have air blast associated with it. The Khobar Towers bombing in 1996 in Saudi Arabia killed 19 U.S. airmen. That bomb was several times larger than the bomb supposed to have been used in Oklahoma. It left a huge 85-foot crater, yet there was no major structural damage on the simple slab building. What happened in Oklahoma City to cause the major horizontal support beam to fail and the complete failure of these 2 series of columns on the east side of the building? This collapse was responsible for most of the casualties. The crater, when seen from above, is offset from the major structural damage in the building. For some reason, the official story has inflated the size of this crater.
The bomb, at least I've seen where the reports from the different agencies have said the bomb extended from the cab to the tail of the truck. And one of the things that really bothers me about that is the rear axle from the truck went down and collided with the car in front of the Regency Tower about a block and a half away. the front axle of the truck was hurled eastbound and struck a parking meter about a block and a half away in front of the YMCA building. The bomb was that big that rear axle would have been driven into the crater, and instead of being split apart as they were, and the truck bomb itself to me had to be between the two axles. It could not have been over that rear axle.
I was surprised from even the FEMA report and the published reports that nobody could determine what the size of the crater was, and that's one of the things I brought up at the grand jury investigation, is that the crater was half the size that they had proposed in the FEMA report. The crater had a 5-gallon bucket sitting next to it after they had it uncovered, and you could extrapolate from the size of that bucket to the size of the hole as to what size of the crater was, and it was approximately 16 feet across.
August 24, 1970, it was a Monday morning. Carlton Armstrong, his brother Dwight, and two other perpetrators, Leo Burt and one other individual, drove up to the side of the Sterling Hall. It was a math research building. Dow Chemical had their offices there. It was federal government as well as the university faculty that worked there. And they had drove a Ford Econoline van stolen from a math professor laden with four metal drums, 50-gallon drums full of ammonium nitrate and fuel oil.
The Sterling Hall bombing consisted of 2,000 pounds of ANFO, and it was set off right next to the building. The windows were blown in, the facade was damaged, but there was no structural damage. In fact, the Army Math Lab was closed for only one day. In Oklahoma City, a similar ANFO bomb detonated 15 feet away from a much more robust structure and inflicted massive structural damage.
What that case did was it was a bellwether. It set a standard for us to look at. It says, okay, if ANFO was in fact used in Oklahoma City, why did it not have the characteristics of what occurred in Madison?
Furthermore, the signature of an ANFO explosion is nitric oxide, a noxious gas.
There was certainly no fertilizer bomb, we know that, because there was no ammonia gas in there in every other explosion, and some students blew up and did make an ammonium nitrate bomb, but everybody who rushed to that building after the explosion had to be hospitalized. If you ever smelled ammonia strongly, and you're talking about going into a horse trade or something like that, that's not strong, but that'll gag you. It will sear your lungs. I mean, everybody that smelled that ammonia gas after the ammonium nitrate bomb at that university had to be hospitalized. It would have been 30 minutes or an hour, depending on how hard the wind was blowing, before anybody could have even approached the Murrah building if there had been an ammonium nitrate bomb.
There were other search and rescue personnel that were down there immediately from St. Anthony's Hospital and nearby, as well as office employees from the surrounding offices. They would have approached the crime scene and buckled over almost immediately, vomiting violently, if there was ammonium nitrate gas. There wasn't.
I was watching General Parton, the former head of Air Force Weapons Development, point out that the building was blown out, that it wasn't the signature of an ammonium nitrate fertilizer bomb, that there had been a cover-up.
The damaged Murrah building drew the attention of retired General Benton K. Parton, former director of the Air Force Armaments Laboratory. General Parton spent his career conducting bomb damage analysis with explosives for the military. General Parton came to Oklahoma City, examined the available evidence, and rendered a conclusion far different than the story being pandered by the government and media.
I spent over 30 years in the Air Force. Most of that was in research and development. I went to a two-year graduate program, 8 quarters of armament engineering graduates, the first course that was ever set up. And after that, I worked at the Ballistic Research Laboratories at Aberdeen, which was 2 years of hands-on work designing, developing continuous rod warhead for the Blue Martin vessel and other weapon systems. Well, the truck bomb, even though it was fairly massive, was somewhat removed from some of the structures that were damaged. It clearly had some what you call Broussant's damage, where the blast pressure was way above what you would expect to get from the truck at that distance.
Broussant's damage is that caused by an explosive whose blast wave is powerful enough to shatter and destroy the material affected. The problem with the failed columns at the Murrah building is at that distance, the air blast from an ANFO bomb would have been 10 times less powerful than what was needed to dissolve the concrete and cut the rebar. Those columns, had they failed due to air blast, should have broken with sharp chunks of concrete connected by rebar, not sheared off at critical points. Broussant's damage indicates contact explosives, placed directly on the beams. Even more perplexing is the total collapse of column B3, which caused the floors on the east side to pancake onto one another. The building was gutted to within feet of the other side. Column B4, closer to the truck bomb, is completely intact. Yet we are supposed to believe that a blast wave traveled through B4, leaving the sheetrock almost untouched, and completely destroyed the column farther away. And most of the front columns were destroyed when the supporting header beam failed. But the cause of failure, supposedly being air blast, should have thrown it into the building. Instead, it fell straight down and rolled towards the crater. General Parton's report was conclusive. The Murrow Federal Building was not destroyed by one sole truck bomb. The major factor in its destruction appears to have been detonation of explosives carefully placed at four critical junctures on supporting columns within the building. Many independent experts concurred with the Parton report. Sam Cohen, inventor of the neutron bomb, issued this statement. I believe that the demolition charges in the building that were placed inside at certain key concrete columns did the primary damage to the Murrow Federal Building. It would have been absolutely impossible, and against the laws of nature, for a truck full of fertilizer and oil, no matter how much was used, to bring the building down. The FBI put all their weight behind the lone bomber theory and tailored the evidence to fit that scenario. Dr. Frederick Whitehurst, a supervisor at the FBI crime lab, turned whistleblower over the Bureau's handling of the evidence in the Oklahoma City bombing.
Released a report today condemning the FBI crime lab for mishandling evidence and for slanting its analysis. The report is expected to specifically criticize the lab's handling of the Oklahoma City and World Trade Center bombing cases. It was the allegations of FBI whistleblower Frederick Whitehurst that sparked that investigation.
Forced to resign, Dr. Whitehurst testified in Terry Nichols' trial that a fellow FBI chemist had changed his findings and lied under oath after meeting with federal prosecutors. The Office of the Inspector General, or OIG, investigated Whitehurst's charges and issued a report which concluded that the FBI crime lab had improperly identified the characteristics of ANFO, the weight of the bomb, the detonation system, and even what kind of explosive was used.
The Oklahoma City case will get a lot of attention because what the Inspector General goes on to at some length to say in his analysis of agent testimony in some of the pre-trial stages is that one agent in particular made sort of seat-of-the-pants estimates about the Oklahoma City bomb, but then couched them in his reports, in his written reports, as being the result of scientific evidence.
The FBI laboratory has built itself for many, many years as the premier forensic laboratory in the world. The people that did the things they did knew doggone well what they were doing.
The Wright Armament Laboratory at Eglin Air Force Base conducted a series of explosive tests to compare their data to the bombing in Oklahoma. The Eglin test structure was a simple three-story concrete slab building with no support columns. The engineers at Eglin tried to recreate the truck bomb as McVeigh and the FBI claimed it was constructed, with 4,000 pounds of ANFO packed into a dozen barrels. But they found that each barrel acted as a separate bomb, canceling out the explosive force of each other and pushing most of the blast upwards. So they constructed a single more powerful bomb and exploded it outside the target building to test the effects of air blast. They found that their weaker test structure suffered less damage from a more powerful bomb than was supposedly used at Oklahoma City. The report for the Wright Laboratory at Eglin Air Force Base concluded, the damage at the Murrow Federal Building is not the result of the truck bomb itself, but rather due to other factors such as locally placed charges within the building. The evidence is undeniable, despite the pleas of the official story, that the Ryder truck bomb was not the sole cause of destruction that day, that there were bombs placed inside the building, which caused the brunt of casualties as floors collapsed on helpless victims.
And the rescuers apparently had to abandon the people they were trying to rescue temporarily.
Were you there a minute ago when somebody yelled they thought they'd seen a second device?
Yes, sir. We were close to the parking area trying to recover a victim.
As rescuers desperately tried to free the victims from the rubble, several evacuations of the site, due to reports of other bombs, impeded these efforts.
At some point, we got to the corner of 5th, and I believe it was Robinson, right there at the corner of the Murrah Building, and we heard second bomb. Somebody yelled second bomb. I stopped. I turned around. People were running past me. and I just kind of watched what was unfolding. Of course, nothing ever did happen.
The Oklahoma Highway Patrol reported that another explosive device was found. The Oklahoma City Fire Department confirmed that. Defense Department logs recorded that a second bomb was disarmed, a third bomb was evacuated.
The explosive that they disarmed last night was even larger.
Who planted these bombs and had access to the Murrah Building before the bombing? A deputy sheriff recorded this footage during one of the evacuations. Here the ATF is seeing pulling out several weapons and blocks of what appeared to be plastic explosive. Was this the source of the bomb scare, or did this ordnance come from an illegal armory that witnesses report the ATF kept in the Murrah Building? The ATF denies they kept any weapons or explosives in the building.
Day one, hour two of the bombing, the most significant event that happened is when they said they found other bombs in the building. The second most significant event was that they moved everybody back and held them back. There were still people alive trapped in the building, but they came in with two trucks and backed them up to the Murrah Building, and a bunch of these guys dressed in blue jackets with no letters on the back started taking boxes of files out and putting them on this truck.
We were told by a blonde female agent that there were files so serious to the government that until the files were located, there would not be any recovery effort.
If you remember the Whitewater investigation in Arkansas, all the paperwork was stored in the Murrah Building. They had FBI agents over in the fields to the west of the Murrah Building picking up paper almost all day long.
And it was during this time that early in the investigation that I started receiving some various phone calls. One of them was a phone call from Little Rock, Arkansas. The guy said that he was a federal agent. He was not an FBI agent. He was not ATF. But what he did say was during their investigation of the Clintons, on the drug running that went through Mena, Arkansas, and you know Lassiter's Ranch, and all of that stuff that was going on at the time during Iran-Contra, that those records, when Clinton went to Washington, were transferred from there to the Murrah Building.
Because of the additional bomb threats, or because the building was unstable and the firefighters couldn't get to them. So those are a lot of patients I think were lost that could have been saved.
After rescue and recovery had been halted, the building was prepped for demolition even though all the bodies had not been recovered and despite the architect's report that it could be rebuilt. The investigative team from the American Society of Civil Engineers was not allowed on site. The defense lawyers from McVeigh were able to visit the site one time, but even then, they were not allowed to view the crater.
They were going to halt it on the 29th of April. They were going to halt the recovery and prepare the building to be imploded. We went back in after the final demolition to relocate two victims that we knew that we had left and the possibility of a third victim, which we also located him. I don't know why they were in such a rush. GSA was saying the building was unsafe and needed to be brought down.
A month after the bombing, the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building was completely demolished with less than 200 pounds of explosives. The wreckage was buried under armed guard, and one can only think that certain officials breathed a sigh of relief as the outstanding counterpoint to the official story disappeared in a cloud of dust. Tidbits of truth about the Oklahoma City bombing would often come from the most unlikely of places. Another strange and brutal murder, at first seemingly unrelated to the bombing, would set the stage for some of the most damning evidence that the government was withholding from the public.
My name is Jesse Trinidou. I'm an attorney from Salt Lake City, Utah. My brother, Kenneth Michael Trinidou, was murdered in the Federal Transfer Center here in Oklahoma City in August of 1995. Kenny had a hard life. You know, I've often thought about that and how he ended up the way he did. He was an incredibly bright man, an incredible athlete. He set the national record in high school for the two-mile run as a freshman. Went into the service, and like so many boys did during the Vietnam War, they come out on the heroin addicts. He robbed banks, or two banks, to support that habit. He was caught and he pled guilty. He went and did his time. He was a very strong guy. He wasn't very big, but he was very tough. He was easygoing, but he wouldn't back down. So if you pushed him, you were going to get a fight, and it was a fight you were going to lose. We loved him and stood behind him, and he was a good man. Kenny was supposedly arrested for a probation violation and sent to Oklahoma City at the transfer center for a probation hearing. We now know that that's crap. I said to him, Kenny, what are you doing there? And he said, well, they sent me back here for a probation hearing. And we talked about getting him a lawyer and the fact that we didn't expect him to do more than a couple months. And so my mother called me at work. It was about 7 in the morning and told me that, and I couldn't believe it. And that Kenny supposedly killed himself because I had just spoken with him the night before. There's no way in hell he would have killed himself. This is not a guy who kills himself. I mean, his life is the best it's ever been. I found out later that an autopsy had already been done. Now, the government, the federal government, didn't want one done, but the state of Oklahoma required one for a death incarceration. So the federal government didn't know there was an autopsy done, did not want the autopsy done, and the federal government went twice to the medical examiner's office asking to have Kenny cremated. It took a week to get his body released and home. And I kept getting the runaround from the federal government, and finally I just screamed into the phone one day, why don't you keep him? And when the body comes home, it's totally made up so you can't see the wounds. He was beaten head to toe. His skull was smashed in 3 places. The soles of his feet had been beaten. You could see the fingerprint bruises on his arm where he'd been held. His throat was cut, and he'd been strangled. And the federal government said it was a suicide by hanging. When his body's turned over to the medical examiner 2 hours later, he's wearing nothing but boxer shorts. The government said they don't know what happened to the clothes. They cleaned the cell that morning so the medical examiner can't do an examination of it. And the medical examiner is not allowed into the cell for 6 months. And when he finally is allowed in, he does a test that's called luminol that will reveal the presence of blood. And Fred Jordan told me that the cell lit up like a Christmas tree. The logbooks involving my brother disappeared. The ones that didn't disappear, the pages from the logbooks are missing. The crime scene photographs disappear. The negatives of the crime scene photographs disappear. The video camera supposedly malfunctions. Within an hour of death, he'd consumed the equivalent of 30 bottles of Coca-Cola. And Dr. Jordan told me that caffeine is used in a lot of countries, like third world countries, to enhance pain under torture. And he also told me that the beatings on the soles of the feet were indicative of torture. And I believe it was the FBI. I firmly believe that for a lot of reasons. Now, I didn't start out believing that. I started out trusting them until I could see what they were doing. And they would come to me asking for information and then immediately go and destroy the evidence, threaten the witness, do everything they could to prevent the case from being made a murder. Information was coming into me. People were leaking me stuff. They wanted me to know. They didn't want me to know who they were. Late December of 95, early January of 96, I get a phone call. The person won't leave their name. The person said your brother was killed by the FBI. They said it was an interrogation that went bad. It was a case of mistaken identity, that he fit a profile of people who are robbing banks to get money to attack the federal government. Just before he was executed, I get a message from Tim McVeigh. And he told me, he said, when I saw your brother's picture and heard what happened to him, I wanted you to know that I think the FBI killed him because they thought he was Richard Lee Guthrie.
Early on, the FBI had investigated the possibility that a string of bank robberies committed by what the media dubbed the Midwest Bank Robbers had financed the bombing. Led by Peter Langan and Richard Lee Guthrie, a.k.a. Wild Bill, the gang called themselves the Aryan Republican Army. The purpose of the robberies? To finance a race war within the United States. Wild Bill closely resembled some of the John Doe No. 2 sketches and had a tattoo similar to that reported by witnesses. In an affidavit, Peter Langan revealed that a member of the ARA had admitted to liabilities concerning the bombing. Another member had threatened, "We're going to get them. We're going to hit one of their buildings during the middle of the day. It's going to be a federal building. Most of the ARA was arrested for bank robbery soon after the bombing. Peter Langan offered to provide information about his co-conspirator's relationship with McVeigh. This offer was refused.
Then I got a call from a great guy, J.D. Cash. He was a hunting and fishing reporter at the McCurtain County News in eastern Oklahoma. He'd had friends that were killed in the bombing and family, wounded. And one day he calls me up and he says, Jesse, can I talk to you? I said, well, sure, who are you? He says, I'm J.D. Cash. He says, I'm investigating the bombing in Oklahoma. He said, I'm interested in your brother's death. Can I ask you some questions? And I said, yes. And J.D. said, well, do you have any tattoos? And I said, yes. He said, what and where? I said, a dragon tattoo on his left forearm. J.D. said, oh, my God. He said, are you sitting down? I said, yeah. He said, let me tell you this. He said, when your brother was picked up and sent to Oklahoma, the largest manhunt in American history was in place for John Doe 2. We didn't start out to solve the Oklahoma City bombing case. We started out for justice for my brother. But every lead, every trail, every bit of important evidence has brought us to the Oklahoma City bombing. Now, the Freedom of Information Act is an act Congress passes that says the government's supposed to turn over documents and information to you that you request, unless there's a good reason not to, such as national security. I bring the first FOIA suit saying I want all documents showing the link between the FBI and the Southern Poverty Law Center and the Oklahoma City bombing. And the FBI comes back and says there are no documents. They didn't know that I'd been leaked two teletypes from FBI Director Louis Free, then Director Louis Free, talking about Ellingham City, talking about informants, talking about the Southern Poverty Law Center, talking about the fact that McVeigh had called Ellingham City 2 days before the bombing asking for more help. So I sue them, and they walk in the court and they tell the federal judge there's no documents. Well, I file those too. The federal judge looks at him and says, you go back, you do a manual search, and you bring everything you find back in the court. Well, then they come back and plead with the judge, and they say, Judge, we promised anonymity, and if we have to disclose these documents, it will reveal their names, and their lives will be in jeopardy.
German citizen Andreas Karl Strassmeier, a.k.a. Andy the German, came to the U.S. in the early 90s. Professing neo-Nazi beliefs, he moved to Ellingham City, becoming their chief of security. He was reported by ATF informant Carol Howe and others to make threats about bombing federal buildings and assassinations of public officials. It is known that McVeigh called Ellingham City twice, looking for the mysterious German, when members of the ARA were living with Strassmeier. McVeigh also attempted to reach Andy's attorney Kirk Lyons by phone in the days before the bombing.
We started looking at Strassmeier real hard, and this guy didn't add up either. He was on special assignment and disappears and shows up in Ellingham City. He came in through Texas and was placed at Ellingham City. Now, why Ellingham City? I mean, nobody in Germany, if I haven't heard of Ellingham City and I live in Oklahoma, how does anybody in Germany hear this place? Well, evidently, it was from a lawyer named Kirk Lyons. I start putting dots together. I start finding out who these people are and who they know and who they run with and what their background and what their history is. And we create a picture from this. We have Strassmeier doing all this paramilitary training, takes over as chief of security of a place that didn't need any security, tells them they need to get rid of their shotguns and deer rifles and buy assault rifles and SKSs and AKs and stuff like this because they're going to be the next Waco. Well, he scares them down there. They don't know what to do, so they start, you know, gearing up for the last days of the Book of Revelation.
Strassmeier is an interesting character, these documents we got from the courts. It's my understanding he's a German intelligence officer. He is apparently, after the bombing, taken out of the country by a former CIA operative back to Germany. His visa, as I understand, had expired, and no one picked him up, and he was smuggled out through Mexico and back to Germany.
I said, why wasn't Andy Strassmeier questioned? And one of the attorneys said, oh, we did question him. I said, yeah, but you waited until he got back to Germany, and then you called him up over the phone and asked him, did he have anything to do with the bombing?
In Tulsa, at Lady Godiva's, which is a strip bar, one of the strippers named Sean T said that McVeigh and Strassmeyer and several people had come in a few days before the bombing, and there was a Ryder truck parked out in the parking lot.
What we can say about Timothy McVeigh's connections to Elohim City is that he called there at least twice, once on April 5th and once on April 17th, that he checked into a motel within miles from there, that he received a speeding ticket within miles from there, and that he also called outlying areas of Elohim City residents or acquaintances. So very briefly, those are his provable connections to Elohim City.
The Southern Poverty Law Center, along with the FBI, kept informants in LOM City. One of these may have been Strassmeyer, the supposed neo-Nazi. Known primarily for its work in litigating against hate groups and its outspoken chief counsel, Morris Dees, the SPLC has also become an informal intelligence gathering arm of the FBI and now the Department of Homeland Security. They share the same interest with the federal government in suppressing what they knew about prior knowledge.
By the FBI's own admission, there were at least between 4 and 6 informants at Elohim City. I don't know what the population of Elohim City is, but it sounds like whenever 3 people get together to talk about overthrowing the government, 2 of them are working for the government.
Andy Strassmeyer's roommate at LOM City was Michael Brescia, a young skinhead from Philadelphia who was also a member of the ARA. He was later convicted for bank robbery and also bore a striking resemblance to the John Doe No. 2 sketches. The FBI and the ATF had something to hide in eastern Oklahoma. Was McVeigh in LOM City? If so, what was he doing?
My name's Josiah Stone, and I was on a spiritual journey. I integrated quite quickly into Elohim City, and I was able to identify with their concept of life because I was looking for some answers to my own life. I saw Timothy McVeigh at Elohim City 8 weeks prior to the Oklahoma City bombing. And I remember him distinctly because he has a distinct face. But he was smiling. He was smiling. He was happy as he could be. These people were loaded for bear, and they were ready. And they meant business. I believe the mindset at Elohim City was they didn't give a damn whether they were implicated in it or not.
What was interesting, and I think no one has paid any attention to it, is that the CIA was involved at Elohim City. Not only were they involved, but they had this spy satellites, the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency. I never heard of them before. They run the spy satellites. They had them over Elohim City. I think one of the things that may be most productive to getting at the truth was the discovery of an operation the FBI had in place since about 1991 called PATCON, P-A-T-C-O-N. Is short for Patriot Conspiracy. It was an idea they had to infiltrate every militia group, every neo-Nazi group, every group critical to the government in the United States. The plan apparently was to put informants in with all of these groups. And I think Elohim City was a PATCON operation. I think McVeigh was obviously involved in it. Now, whether he was a target or an operative, I don't know, any more than I know whether the government intended to blow up the Murrow Building. But they knew it was going to happen, and they knew McVeigh was going to do it, and they don't stop him.
As alleged in David Hoffman's book, The Oklahoma City Bombing and the Politics of Terror, Strassmeyer first aroused suspicion that he was an undercover operative when he was caught in Texas entering a federal building at night with a key code. Did he have access to the Murrah Building also?
When we interviewed Jane Graham, who was a survivor, she said that when she went to work, it was either the day before or 2 days before, I don't remember which, she parked in the basement parking, and when she got out of her car and was walking across the parking garage, she saw 3 guys down there wearing coveralls and placing putty on the columns and stringing wire between the putty. Later, she picks out one of the guys from photographs and says, that's him, and it was Andreas Strassmeyer.
Strassmeyer was there listening, going over the plans. He was listening to everything. He was, what they were talking about, looking at place, pointing to things. But when they were talking, whatever they happened to finally be talking about, and when I was looking at him at that point, then he left and went over to the other side of the building so I wouldn't keep watching him. The second man that was there, who appeared to be military, he's the one that the man in charge told to put the stuff back in the car. The second man obviously was taking orders from the first man because he had wire in his hands, which I thought was telephone wire. It's that real light color, thin wire. And he also had what appeared to be gray putty.
Well, that's exactly how you string composition C4 with detcord.
And the details are chilling. We'll also focus on surveillance cameras, cameras that caught the bombing on tape, and maybe the men behind the bombing. The news channel has new information tonight that there's a chance surveillance tapes could be the smoking gun evidence. Now, we asked candid questions in a rare face-to-face meeting with ATF officials close to the investigation. We learned that video collected from downtown businesses the morning of April 19th may someday be played before a jury. Officials won't say who or what exactly is on the tape. However, numerous sources have confirmed the tapes exist and that they reveal more than one bomber.
And I said, I want two other things from the FBI. I want the tapes from the surveillance cameras leading up to the Murrow buildings on the day of the bombing, on the different buildings around the Murrow building. And I want the tapes from the cameras on the Murrow building, because I had received a government document that said surveillance cameras show the bomb detonating 3 minutes and 6 seconds after the suspects exited the truck. Suspects, not one, plural. The fight now is over those tapes. They don't deny they exist. They just say we can't find them. Now, the notion that this is the biggest crime the Bureau had ever investigated at that point in time, the largest mass murder in American history, the two most important pieces of evidence you have, the arrest of McVeigh and the videotape showing McVeigh delivering the bomb to the Murrow building, you can't find? Incredible.
The enhanced photo shows a very distinct possibility of a man standing behind that truck. And the time sequence camera took additional photographs. So will those additional photographs show there was a man there? Will they show that he was alone? Will it show it was the suspect, Tim McVeigh? The additional photographs in the trial should help point that out.
I think one of the things that stands out to me is the fact that, during that first morning while we were being held at bay from doing any recovery work, there were FBI agents, or at least men in FBI raid jackets, dismantling the video cameras off the side of the building.
I'm Charlie Rose. I'm with Legend Video Transfer, and the FBI had employed me to duplicate a number of videos for them shortly after the Murrah bombing. I was asked to duplicate approximately 400 tapes for the FBI. We had two FBI agents in the office. We had two studios set up for duplication, and each FBI agent was required to stay in the room with each of us that were in that room. Really didn't have the opportunity to sit back and watch the videos. There's probably a lot to learn, you know, from the videos that they saw. Some of them are meaningless, but others, you know, could make some powerful impact on what actually happened.
The government will not release the film that was on the in the video cameras on the front of the building that would show whether I was accurate or not accurate.
Of course, the other Achilles heel is the videotapes of the building itself from the different surveillance cameras that no one's seen. If McVeigh was Lee Harvey McVeigh all by himself, the lone nut with the truck, then why don't they show us the videotapes of the truck? Show us the videotapes of him getting out. Or was there more than him in the truck?
There were like 20, 22 films
in the area that were confiscated by the FBI that would have shown the truck being pulled up, people getting out of the truck. It would have shown what was going on at the time the explosions took place. And obviously they confiscated those, and it didn't take much to figure out that the federal authorities weren't trying to get to the truth. They seemed to be covering up things.
Their first objective is to protect the agency, not to do what's right, not to do justice, not to serve the American people. It's to protect themselves. And they will do anything, anything to do that.
Tim McVeigh was honorably discharged from the Army 3 years before the bombing, leaving behind an exemplary service record. After a brief but intense combat experience in the Persian Gulf War, McVeigh tried out for the Special Forces. He pronounced himself unable to continue just a few days into the testing and returned to his unit demoralized and, some say, a changed man.
Through being able to see Timothy McVeigh's letters to his defense team, this is really behind-the-scenes stuff, letters to his family, the memos that the defense team writes, which detail his mood from day to day, some of the medical reports while he's in prison, which detail his thoughts. On the one hand, you have the McVeigh who's mad at the government. On the other hand, you have the McVeigh who works for the government. The defense team themselves could never obtain his full military records, and that even though they were ordered by a judge.
Where does he turn up? He turns up in Buffalo, New York. And while he's up there, he creates what's known as a legend. Now, legend is when you go undercover or you get sheep-dipped. Sheep-dipped means you change your identity, you change your who you work for, and become a new person. He changes his personality up there, and all of a sudden, he's ranting and raving about the Turner Diaries and overthrowing the government and all this other nonsense to where they're going. This guy's a wacko. He works up there 6 months and disappears. Where do we find him again? Going into militia meetings and doing the same thing, making sure he's noticed.
If you look at Lee Harvey Oswald and Tim McVeigh and other patsies, they're very similar. They're in the military. They've got security clearances.
McVeigh wrote a letter to his sister, who turned it over to the FBI, in which he admits that he was selected out of Special Forces training to participate in covert operations, to help run drugs to fund these operations, and to assassinate security risks. Mere bravado, or was McVeigh telling the truth?
The FBI had put wiretaps on the McVeigh family's phone after the bombing. And so I'm reading this conversation back and forth between his mother and his sister. There's actually a few of these conversations where they say, we don't understand why the FBI won't listen to us and why the media is reporting that Timothy McVeigh washed out or dropped out of Special Forces. They're saying, no, we were told that he was still active in the military and that he was working on these covert missions.
And he told his family, he told many others, Terry Nichols has signed an affidavit, that McVeigh believed he was out there infiltrating militias and right-wing groups and was preparing to set them up. And then, of course, he later learned that he was the guy that got set up.
If McVeigh was working for the government, what are we to make of the involvement of Terry Nichols, the only convicted accomplice?
When Nichols had been convicted, but not given the death penalty, in federal court and in state court, he could not be tried again. He wrote to Attorney General, then Attorney General Ashcroft, and said, come and see me. Come and see me, and I'll tell you all about it.
In his declaration, Nichols stated that crucial parts of this terrorist attack remain hidden from the American people, especially the identities of others unknown who collaborated with McVeigh in the bombing. McVeigh told Nichols that he had been recruited to perform undercover missions while in the U.S. Army. Always the good soldier, McVeigh revealed only one name in his chain of command, Larry Potts, assistant director of the FBI and the lead agent on the Ruby Ridge catastrophe in 1992, in which a U.S. Marshal and 14-year-old Sam Weaver and his mother Vicki Weaver were killed. Larry Potts later played an active role in the siege at Waco. McVeigh was angry at Potts for going off script and changing targets at the last minute. Another telling clue is on Tim McVeigh's death certificate. Despite being officially out of the military for 9 years and having held many different jobs since then, His listed occupation was U.S. Army. So why did Tim McVeigh take the fall for his accomplices? Perhaps the intervention of a known psychological warfare expert explains his silence till the end.
The record clearly shows that Dr. Jolyon West consulted Timothy McVeigh's defense team. Dr. West had previously been a psychiatrist and consulted for Patty Hearst, Saran Saran, and Jack Ruby.
We know that Jolyon West was considered to be the number two mind control expert in North America under only Dr. Ewing Cameron.
Dr. West came under a lot of scrutiny during his time as chief of psychiatry at UCLA because he was proposing using prisoners, the general community, poor people, minorities as test subjects. And then West's career continues to flourish through the 80s, and he continues his research into hypnosis, branches out into terrorism and cults, even consulting and later writing about the Waco massacre.
Dr. John Smith, that's even his real name, was the protege of Dr. Jolyon West, you know, Mr. Mind Control, and he was McVeigh's doctor in prison. Today it's reported that he is one of the head psychiatrists, one of the head doctors at Guantanamo Bay. The fact that you've got the protege, one of the fathers of modern mind control, now being the head of psychiatry at Guantanamo Bay, which is an admitted mind control laboratory, that's even mainstream news. I mean, you couldn't make this up in a spy novel. Truth is always stranger than fiction, and it's all hidden in plain view.
Was the bombing the product of a sting gone out of control, with McVeigh taking the blame for a series of government failures?
They kind of set up a sting operation, it appears to me, that went bad. They thought they would stop, the efforts of Strassmeyer, Millar, and others through Elohim City.
I eventually talked to the Senate staffer, and he informed me that the Oklahoma City bombing was actually a sting operation that went wrong, and that the effort to cover it up was because they were not able to stop the sting operation.
When it fell apart in that they weren't able to stop it right before it took place and proclaim to the public how great they were so they could get new funding for the ATF because the ATF had lost so much credibility due to the Randy Weaver situation.
I don't know if anybody will ever know. I know my brother was killed. I'm often asked why. I know my brother was killed for information he didn't have about the bombing. Why the people in the Murrow Building were killed. As I said, I don't know if they intended it or it just got away from them. God, I hate to think that they did it on purpose.
Perhaps it was a deliberate attack by a criminal element in this government using the reins of power to execute and cover up their crime.
In 2006, the American behavioral scientist published the whole journal on this concept that's being developed called a state crime against democracy, SCAD for short. There's a recognition, a growing recognition among academia that oftentimes people have not pursued culpability into elite crimes for the fear of being called a conspiracy theorist. When there is a state crime against the people, what generally happens is that inquiries into these crimes tend to be highly controlled, tightly framed, and totally reliant on agencies who stand to be embarrassed by investigations.
It's now been declassified at the Gulf of Tonkin in 1964 to get the United States fully committed into the Vietnam War. Was a staged event, and those LBJ tapes have been released. Were days before McNamara is telling him on the phone how they're going to stage the event to get the United States into the war and what he would need to say at those press conferences. In early 1995, the entire United States was politically awakening. The population was angry about Waco. They were angry about the United States losing its sovereignty and Bill Clinton trying to pass anti-Second Amendment legislation. The federal government was forced to basically come in and create a crisis so they could demonize anyone who thought the government was too big or out of control. In 1994 and 1995, the Congress had tried unsuccessfully to pass their omnibus crime bill that expanded federal jurisdiction, that went after the Second Amendment, that was going to create all these new federal agencies to spy on the American people. And that was one of the reasons that Oklahoma and other states were upset. They understood this was totally unconstitutional and a huge federal overreach, and it violated the Tenth Amendment. But after the Oklahoma City bombing tragedy, suddenly they were able to rename it as the Anti-Terrorism Effective Death Penalty Act, and that was able to sell through.
Well, I think one of the things we'll be seeing over the next few weeks and months are new legislation, both to deal with domestic groups and international terrorism. There's already one bill, the Omnibus Terrorism Act of 1995, that's on the cards. One of the dangers is that we stepped a little bit too far, and this bill is very controversial.
But we see amazing parallels between Oklahoma City and 9/11, and we see it also being used as a mass conditioning tool to launch a new war. In the case of Oklahoma City, a war against the American people. In the case of 9/11, a war against the Middle East and an invasion for resources.
President Obama's chief of staff, Rahm Emanuel, recently said that you can never let a good crisis go to waste. This is an example of real politic. Taken to its extreme, we can quote the words of Robert Shapiro, former Clinton advisor, who recently wrote in an editorial that the only thing that can save the Obama administration is another terror attack like Oklahoma City or 9/11. So they think of us as expendable. They're willing to ride our ashes, stand on our graves to preserve their position. This is an example of the noble lie.
And in the months and weeks building up to the Oklahoma City bombing, there was incredible conditioning on the news. These people are scared of the federal government. They're terrorists. They're going to kill you. They're going to bomb you. You watch. It's going to happen. And then sure enough, it happened. And then you look at the evidence, and government and black op fingerprints are all over it. The establishment is going to have trouble in the future orchestrating further atrocities like Oklahoma City, because the public is now really getting wise to their tricks. Oklahoma City is one of the best examples we've got where we can prove clearly that the official story is a fraud, that the government was involved and is using it to demonize good Americans.
April 19, 1995, will live on in history as a reminder that we must all take an active role in holding our leaders accountable. Its legacy and lessons must be rooted in truth, not myth. The victims demand truth and justice. We have all witnessed firsthand the harsh reality of a government's ability to manifest its will upon the people. And it's up to the people to deprive governments of the power to commit crimes and profit from the lies.
It is every patriotic American's duty, every man, woman, and child's responsibility to research the facts contained in this film, to verify for yourself that this information is true and that the rabbit hole goes even deeper, and then take action to bring the criminals that perpetrated this attack to justice.
Hello, hello, everybody out there. Woohoo! Here we are. It is Friday night, and you were just listening to the documentary A Noble Lie, Oklahoma City Bombing 1995, done by Holland Vandenumenoff, who was a previous guest on my show twice. Actually, he was one of the two guests, that my first guest on the show, along with Richard Gage. So that was the first time that he was on. It was kind of a double feature way back in September of 2021. And then he was on a second time on March 19th, 2023. And if you're looking at the show description, which, by the way, you only have about 40 seconds to call in before the audio will drop. If you're listening online, call in right now in the next 30 seconds, 563-999-3485. Otherwise, your audio will drop, and you won't be able to continue on with us. So call in now in the next 15 seconds, 563-999-3485. I see Mike and Boyd and Cinnamon and a Skype caller and Suzette or Robert, one of the two. It might be Suzette, hopefully. Also in the switchboard right now. And looks like Joe Gibson as well has called in. Good, good. Since now we are officially into the bonus hour. So glad that you guys snuck in while you still could. So I had Holland Vandenumenoff. He is one of the main producers and writers of that documentary. And it's a really good documentary. And when he was on my show, especially the second time when it wasn't the double feature, when he was on last March, he got into some things that, you know, weren't included in this documentary. Because as with most documentaries, there was like way more material. And so some stuff had to be kind of left out in order to, you know, fit in stuff within a 2-hour time frame for this documentary. So if you ever want to take a gander at it, look at the show description, and I have links to when he was on both times, 9:26 and then also 3:19. So sometime if you, you know, just want to give him a listen. You know, some of you out there might not have been familiar with my show back then. Maybe you missed the shows. But it was a very good interview with him. He's a really good guy. Big fan of his. So, anywho, why don't we bring some people on the line here. We got Mike raising his hand. Make sure to press 1 if you want to join the conversation. Hey, Mike, how you doing? Happy Friday. Are you there? Hello? Am I alone? Just making sure here. Hopefully I'm not talking to myself. My phone isn't muted. And I'm not muted on the switchboard. Oh, you're here. Good. Okay.
My question is this. My question is this. It read like, I'm not asking questions. It read like 9/11 all over again, right? I mean, how did the building react the way it reacted? One side pancaked down. The other side was blown out. All right. How did that happen? Usually one or the other is going to happen, not both of them at the same time, right? So how'd that happen? I mean, this reads like a demolition job all over the place, right? Another demolition job.
Exactly. It's almost like Oklahoma City was kind of like almost like a practice for 9/11. There's so many elements that are similar in what happened there, especially some of these mysteries, and deliberately, in my opinion, botched investigations, the official narrative versus eyewitness testimony. You know, so many similar things as with 9/11. So it's like I said, it's like it was a practice run. I'm going to go ahead and bring Joe Gibson on in with us.
Actually, Marianne, think of it this way. They're talking about these trucks with the bombs in them. What happened just a year before this happened, or maybe a couple of years before this happened? The first Trade Center bombing, right? What was that? That was bombs there's some fuel and oil bombs that were set off and did very little damage to the Trade Center, but they were set inside the Trade Center parking lot or whatever it was at the time, parked by the Trade Center, and they proved they could get stuff in there and do stuff. So that, I mean.
Yeah, that was February 26th of 1993, so just a little over 2 years before Oklahoma City, yeah.
Right. So think about it. Look at the situation, both situations. You got, in 1993, you have the first Trade Center bombing using trucks, but it was an unsuccessful bombing, but that was a test case. All right? In my mind, that was a test case to see what they could get away with and how close they could get to blowing something up. They didn't have this that happened almost a year and a half later, or whatever it was, and they used the same thing. They used the same modus operandi with the trucks and the fuel and the nitrogen and all that stuff based stuff, and they parked it by the building, just like they did with the 1993 Trade Center bombing, and here we go again, right? Now, granted, there was a little bit more to this one because it appears that they had put, I mean, if you trust this guy, which I kind of do, they, it looks like they put all this, they had explosives inside the building just like they did, just like it seemed like they did on 9/11, right? You know, so again, 1993, Oklahoma City, and then 9/11, very much jive with each other.
I can't argue with you there. Absolutely. Man, it looks like we have some competition with Crazy Ron here. Looks like he's starting up a show.
Oh, boy. Actually, he's high, Ron.
He's high, Ron. Yeah, I haven't partaken yet tonight. About 10 minutes before
what happened to Robert,
the clip ended, I made myself a drink, and I haven't partaken yet. And a
what
little nuggy
Robert,
in my
Joe?
Bowl, so I got some catching up to do with Ron. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
What happened with Robert's show? What happened?
He said in the chat, he got back to me, said that he forgot that it was Friday. He thought that it was Thursday all day long. And he had set up a show. That's the weird part. He said he set up a show at a time like he usually does, and it disappeared. So I don't know if that was some of the Blog Talk issues that happened earlier this week or something that maybe it didn't save. I don't know. But anyway, he had set up an episode. And so when I went in earlier today and I saw that there wasn't an episode set up for tonight, and then that's when I emailed him and messaged him like, hey, you know, I don't see a show set up. Did something come up or what? You know, but anyway.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and
well,
he didn't call in in time.
Part.
But so it was
part.
Basically just getting his days mixed up. Was the issue. Thankfully,
okay.
That's all
right.
It was, because I was getting kind of worried.
All right. Anyway, on the documentary part, first of all, the blame goes on the jury, okay? The jury convicted that man. They killed him, obviously. They set him up. And the jury, they're bastards, and may they burn in hell for what they did, because they are part of the destruction of this republic. They had the power to send a message, and they didn't do it. So they're the guilty ones,
Your
Honor.
I want to agree with you, but think about it. With a cover-up going on, I mean, I wonder with the jury, how much were they actually shown? You know, how much evidence was thrown out that they never saw it or never considered it? How much evidence was hidden? How much eyewitness testimony did they not present? You know, how many eyewitnesses didn't have the chance to get up on the stand and tell their story about what they saw or what they heard or what they knew?
Well, so
in the defense of the jury, they could have had, they probably had a very well-crafted and well-put-together a case against Tim McVeigh by excluding a lot of stuff, you know, so stuff that they never even knew existed. And who knows, maybe some of those jurors were like, man, if I would have known this, I wouldn't have rendered a verdict the way I did.
Yeah,
you never know,
well,
you know.
Let's put it this way. If you're selected to a jury, Lorian, yeah, obviously you know what's going on in this country, so you have no excuse. And I'm sure they're from Oklahoma, most of those people. They knew what was going on, and that Waco just happened prior to that. Ruby Ridge happened prior to that. We all know what's going on. Even though we weren't in the dot-com world yet, we still knew what was going on. We're all awake. And if you're asleep, and surely 12 members of a jury were not all asleep. It only takes one to say not guilty. So, therefore, you can't tell me unanimously all 12 were all dead sheep, didn't know what was going on. That's the problem in this country. We, the jurors, this is the only form of republic government we have left in this country. And we keep convicting people. Unless this son of a bitch is saying, yeah, I did it, and he's signing a statement, I did it, I say, let everybody go. Not guilty. Not guilty. Start creating that case law. Not guilty. Not guilty. We got to, I mean, that's, it's so simple. You know, I mean, if there's any doubt at all in your mind, that person has to walk not guilty. If there's any doubt, any, that sliver of it, it's not the scales of the evidence. It's not, well, I heard this much, well, this much. No, it's any type of reasonable doubt. You walk in a republic. That's how it is. That's why our system is so great. That's why the minority always gets the rights. That's why we forget this, because we're a democracy. Majority rules. No. No, we're a republic. So that's why, I mean, there's too many people sitting in prison today. Too many people that are wrong, that, you know, and too many people are convicted of lawsuits and these judgments that are given. No, no, man, we've got to use the republic form to restore our republic. That's another way. Everyone should have a jury handbook in their back pocket.
Right.
Oh, absolutely. And there is such a thing as jury nullification. And even though, you know, the judges and lawyers will, you know, try to convince the jurors that it doesn't exist or it's not a thing or they shouldn't do it, it's still jury nullification. But again, going back to that time, we're talking 1995. And, you know, I think that, like, before 9/11 happened, I mean, I know I've talked about it a lot. 9/11 was my wake-up call. 9/11 was when I finally started going, hey, wait a fucking minute here, you know. This doesn't add up. And then that's what had me look at events in the past in a different light. And so back in 1995, when this bombing happened, I think we were still kind of in this like mental age of innocence, if that makes sense. You know, there just wasn't a lot of people that were awakened yet. And
Ruby Ridge
so
woke me up.
Maybe
so
that's part of it.
Ruby, you know.
Yeah.
Ruby Ridge woke me up.
Oh, Ruby Ridge and Waco was me. You know? And the matter is, I think that, I mean, they were getting into the, I don't want to say the weeds, but into the actual crime, but it's what they said he was reading, what they said that McVeigh was reading at the time, which was this thing called the Turner Diaries. All right, which was a book about somebody blowing up a federal building. All right, and that's where they say he got the idea. Now it's a book written by a so-called neo-Nazi, but that's what they say he was reading at the time, or he had read at the time, and so. That's where they say he got the idea from it, from, you know, and they at the time they were calling him a Nazi and all that stuff, which may or may not have been true, but again, that's not the point. The point was what he was reading, the kind of reading materials he was taught, he was reading, you know. And it's like, okay, I mean, yeah, the jury could have done better, but again, how many times over the past years, the past handful of years, have we said, you know, in terms of juries, they could have done better. You know, it's not just that one. It's not just the OJ jury. It's not just, you know, the 9/11 jury. It's not just the 9/11 thing. It's not just, you know, things like, you know, the jury that put these guys, put the J6 guys in jail. Well, here we go. I mean, what evidence would all those juries? I mean, look, the LJ jury put that aside because that was going to be a not guilty plea anyway, right? But all the rest of these juries that would have been evidence to either say that he didn't act alone, they didn't act alone, or evidence to get people off, you know, that the juries didn't see. I mean, it goes back to what evidence was shown to the jury in the courtroom. If you're getting incomplete evidence, you're gonna have the incomplete picture of what, you know, if the judge says this evidence stays and this evidence goes, well, the judge is supposedly in control of the courtroom, and the jury is not going to get the total, complete picture, right? So, I mean, you might fault the jury in this case, but I kind of think that a lot of it was that there was certain evidence that wasn't allowed in the case, in the courtroom, because basically what it would have done is it would have thrown stuff onto the Clintons.
Look what they did to that police officer. Oh, my God. Tortured a man.
Yep.
And I know exactly what that guy was going through, man. I just know it because I could tell that's probably going to happen.
I know. I couldn't help but think of you. You know, I was like, this must be ringing way too true with Joe over there because, yeah, you know, it I think, you know, there's like a smoking gun with some of these incidences, and I think that police officer was his death being ruled a suicide. The way it was described is absolutely not a suicide, and I that's the smoking gun right there, I think, is
exactly.
What did he see? You know, what did he see that they needed to make sure to suicide him?
He tortured him.
You know,
him.
We'll never know.
We'll never know, guys. And that's the thing. The other thing I'll say about it, I didn't know that they had a bunch of files on Mena, Arkansas, and Whitewater over there in that building.
Oh yeah, Mena, Arkansas. That was a big thing. That was all over the country. Anybody who worked for the government or had any ties knew about Mena. Everyone did. I heard stories about it when I was inside the prison. You know, so Barry Seal, all that crap.
Well, I knew about the stories. I just didn't know the files were in that particular building in Oklahoma City.
You know, they had them everywhere, files for that damn place. So that Mena Arkansas, that was so big. That's the biggest thing that hit this country.
Yep. You know, and on the same thought, before I forget, you know, the other part of the documentary that, you know, like had me say, you know, Joe Gibson in my head, was when they were talking about Timothy McVeigh's history, you know, with the military and his family going, wait a minute, I never knew he was discharged. He didn't get discharged right away. he thought that he was helping to bring down militias and stuff. And it's like, boy, does that sound like Joe Gibson or what? Because, you know, you're supposed to be bringing down drug cartels, you know, and you were set up, you know, you survived. You were supposed to survive, you know, but you survived twice.
So
and
far.
So I guess they gave up because they couldn't do it a third time and have not, you know, and without people getting suspicious, like, okay, you know. It reminded me so much of you. I'm like, you know all about that. Anyway, sorry, I wanted to get that out before it exits my brain because I got 5 seconds.
But that
brain.
Just proves
you know
how they lie. You know, that just proves how everyone should be angry because it can happen to you. It can happen to your neighbor. It can happen to your son. It can happen to your brother, your sister. It can happen, you know, it can happen. And that's just showing proof, you know, that you got. It's got to piss people off. It's got to make people angry to make a change.
You're right. It could happen to any one of us. We could just be, you know, going to the bank to get, you know, do an ATM withdrawal, or we could just be, you know, on our way to shopping or something. We could just be walking down the street and witness something happen, you know. And lo and behold, we don't know that because we witnessed whatever it is that happened, now we're on somebody's kill list, you know.
Yeah.
You never know. It can happen to anybody.
I'm gonna say something right here forget about your problems with Trump right now, Lorianne. Look at what they're doing with him, and think about this. What does he always say? They're coming after me because I'm in the way, right? Well, what I heard a guy say this earlier today that. They're not actually going after Trump. They're coming after us by going after Trump. You know. So this is an attack on the American people. What they're doing with Trump. You know. So again, and as another all these rig trials and all that stuff. So what does that sound like? That sounds like. You know, you look at all this stuff, and you look at the trial with the Timothy McVeigh trial. You could argue that was a rigged trial. They wanted him found guilty.
Yeah, you know, I just saw that the judge in the case of the Proud Boys guy just handed down like the harshest sentence yet. You know, and I don't think it's any accident. With the Trump trials going on and the cases going on, that happened the way it did. You know, it was an Obama-appointed judge that just issued, I think it's like 5.5 years to that guy. I got to pull up the article, but that just happened today.
Really?
And so it's like these coincidences just keep happening. Let me pull up the article. Where the hell is it? I know I posted it on my...
Well, here's the deal. The thing with that is, Lorianne, there's this case in the Supreme Court that if it goes the right way, whatever this thing is going to happen with this sentence with the Proud Boys, it's going to go away with the Supreme Court case. It's just going to... The sentence is gonna poof go away.
Why?
They gotta let them free.
Maybe not. So here's the article. Like I said, this just happened today. U.S. District Judge Tanya Chutkan sentenced former Maryland Proud Boys leader Scott Miller to more than 5 years in prison on Friday for his role in January 6th riot on Capitol Hill, marking her toughest sentence yet. Hundreds of participants in the riot have received jail time for their role in the incident. Chutkan's 66-month sentence on Friday, however, nudges out the 63-month sentences she gave to Robert Palmer and Mark Ponder, both of whom were convicted of violent offenses. Miller's sentence is slightly less than 5 years and 11 months that prosecutors sought. Chutkan said she based her sentence on Miller's violence at the Capitol, but also on his private writings that included calls for violence against minorities and Jews. Miller, who pleaded guilty to assaulting police officers during the riot, claims to have disavowed these violent beliefs. The Obama-appointed judge praised the work of the Capitol Hill and Metro Police, who were on site during the riot, claiming they were patriots who were outnumbered on the day of the attack. But she also warned that the riot could happen again in the future. Capitol Police faced horrendous circumstances. They were assaulted, spat on, beaten, kicked, and gassed, Trutkin said.
Yeah, right.
They are patriots, but it can happen again. Extremism is alive and well in this country. Threats of violence continue unabated. Miller attacked officers with makeshift weapons, seven different kinds. Some of the weapons include a bottle, a stick, and poles, according to the Associated Press. The former Proud Boy leader, who helped lead a chapter in Maryland and Washington, D.C., apologized for his role in the riot and for attacking the officers, and said he wanted to be a good example for his child. His wife, a mental health counselor who is 20 weeks pregnant with their first child, was also present in court at his sentencing. So that's the article.
Okay, here's what this case is. And I'm looking at it from, it says Supreme Court hears argument on constitutionality of J6 obstruction charges. That's what they're charging these people with. That's what they're going to charge with this guy with, is obstruction of an official government thing, right? Government business or whatever, for what they did on January 6th, which is a lie, which is, you know, so if this guy gets sentenced for obstruction charges, and the case in the Supreme Court, you know, says, no, you can't do that, he's going to get out scot-free right away, just about. So, you know, that's basically what they're trying to get him on, is obstruction of a official government proceeding, right? Obstruction.
If Trump is elected, it doesn't matter. They should all be pardoned. That's what he said he's going to do.
Yep. Well,
he
may
not
have to give them pardons. Now, granted, it, just because the Supreme Court says something don't mean the feds have to do it. They can give them the old double barrel middle finger and say, fuck you, we're not going to do it. You know, we're not going to let them go, even though you told us to let them go. You know, they can do that. And then when Trump gets back in, he'll pardon them, and he'll send whomever over there, the National Guard or whatever, to the D.C. Gitmo and get these people out, you know. But the DC gulag, whatever you want to call it, fucker. But yeah, and this case happened 3 days ago. These arguments about this obstruction charge, these obstruction charges happened 3 days ago in the Supreme Court. Now, we won't know until probably June, about what they've ruled, what the Supreme Court has ruled in this matter. All right? But, again, it is what it is, right? So we'll see. And, look, this...
We'll see, all right. We're going to see.
Yeah,
we're going to feel
it. All these people, all these judges are crooked and are not above board and are just over-sentencing people all over the place. You know, Chutkin needs to be taken off the court and done away with, but he needs to get at these people, you got to make them suffer real political damage. And how do you get real political damage on these people, like these judges? You impeach them, you get them off the courts. You know? Now, will Trump be able to do that? I don't know, but will somebody like Trump be able to do that, or will the Senate, will the U.S. Senate be able to do that? I don't know. We'll see. But that's what they're going to have to do with these people, is get them off the courts, away. You know, it may not do, it may do little to clean up the courts, but it would help. You know, to get these illegal, crooked judges off the court. I mean, you got Chutkin, and you got freaking, what's his name, McAfee over there in Georgia. You got, what's his name in New York, the freaking, that's in the hush money, well, the NDA case up there with Trump now. He's got serious problems. But, yeah, we'll see. And I'm not saying that judge in that case, in the case was a crooked in the case for the Murrah building against Tim McVeigh, was or wasn't a crooked judge. I don't know. But I mean, think about it. You got a question, how much evidence that should have been introduced was kept out of the case at the time? Right, Lorianne?
Exactly. I mean, did the jurors hear about the testimony from the guy kind of toward the start of that documentary, saying that he saw the truck parked like in this, you know, kind of around this lake, you know, in that area, and all of that kind of stuff. I mean, I don't know. I mean, are there still transcripts available of what happened during that case that people can read and kind of understand what evidence was and was not included? I don't know, you know, probably have to do some digging to find that out, but I'd be willing to bet that the jury only heard a very well-crafted series of evidence so that they would draw the conclusion and give the verdict that they did.
Sure.
I would not doubt it one bit, because that's how it goes, you know. I've only been a juror once in my life, and it was for a civil case. And I don't know how many times during that civil case that, you know, some evidence was going to be presented, and then it was determined, no, we're not going to present that, jury disregard, or we'd have to leave the room because the attorneys wanted to present evidence. And then we'd come back in the room and just proceed and like, no, you know, we ruled this evidence, you know, irrelevant, and so we never heard it, that kind of thing. So it just lends me to think that, you know, juries are misled all the time based on even something little could be completely legitimate evidence, but they make up, you know, they come up with an argument on why it should be excluded. Oh, it wasn't, you know, obtained, or it's hearsay or some technicality where crucial parts of evidence are excluded and the jury never hears it. And they should, you know, it's like, It as much as I want to, you know, be on the side of somebody that's defending themselves, at the same time, though, I think it's an injustice to have all of these loopholes where legitimate evidence is thrown out, you know, that would absolutely either exonerate or prove the guilt of somebody, one way or the other. It can work both ways because they'll exclude evidence that completely clears somebody. And then the jury is left only hearing the evidence against them, even though there's this huge piece of evidence that proves their innocence, that would prove it well beyond a reasonable doubt. But some loophole or some technicality excludes that evidence. And so the jury doesn't even know it exists. And then, of course, they rule, you know, in light of that. That's part of what's wrong with our justice system. And I see Boyd is finally raising his hand, so I'm going to bring Boyd on in. Hey, Boyd.
Hey, you know, that's what happened in that E. Jean Carroll trial with Trump. They wouldn't let them bring in evidence on E. Jean Carroll's character. You know, of what her past was and everything.
Because you can't bias the jury, right? You know.
Yeah.
You want to bias that jury in a certain way, and you can't, you know, bias them in another way by allowing that kind of, you know, character reference. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, when he did his interview with on CNN, he was talking about, well, she named her cat Vagina, you know, that type of stuff. You know, this woman is weird.
That
She's
is fucking
weird,
I gotta say. I've owned a lot of cats in my life, and I have never once thought to name it Vagina. You know, I've never thought to name one of my male cats Penis. You know what I mean? Like,
well, I mean, look.
And
what
if I did, that would be something that goes like, okay, what's wrong with this chick? It would go to my character.
Well, I mean,
I'm naming animals that.
Well, what's another name for a cat? They call it a pussy cat, right? Right?
Yeah, they call it pussy cat. Yeah.
So apparently, she thought that would be a great name for a cat, his Vagina. Apparently.
Which is dumb. Like, I don't even know, like, when did pussy become a reference to a woman's genitals? When did that happen? Because I remember, like, this book that my grandma used to read to me called The Pussy Willow. And the pussy willow is a plant, you know? It's just a plant. You know, but of course now the connotation is very different, you know, when you say pussy willow. You know, but I know when I was a kid, you know what I mean? Like, it didn't mean anything other than that, like, to me anyway, because I was a kid. But
well,
I kind of am curious, like,
I
when
guess,
did pussy become the term, you know? What's the historical thing about that? Somebody go Google search it.
I guess it's better than being called tuna.
That's true. That's true. I'd rather be called a pussy than be called tuna. Because tuna implies a stinky one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Here's your stink.
Stinking
up the whole fucking room. Close your legs.
I mean, I used to watch a lot of PBS, and one of the shows on there at the time was this thing, Are You Being Served? It's a British show, right? And one of the characters was always talking about her cat, and all she would say is, my pussy. You know? That's it. When she was talking about her cat, right? So, this and this, and so, now that's an English thing, I guess, you know, English, but anyway, that's what I heard anyway. But then again, this woman, there's a sex advice columnist, number one. Number two, this, it's been proven that her story is a friggin' edition of Law and Order, from an edition of Law and Order. Number three, you know, why would Trump, even if it's true, all right, why would Trump, you know, when he has a hotel across the street from this one, from this store, why would he say, I'm going to go into, you know, a dressing room to do whatever when I've got a hotel right across the street from us, from the store, from Berko Goodman's, right? Why would he do that? That's another thing they didn't allow in the case with Trump. But that's these judges. These judges, oh, we're not going to allow all this stuff about her character in this case, and then we're going to say, you're guilty anyway, and you got to pay $83 million. That's what they did. That's exactly what they did. Let me ask you this, Lorianne. Has our Skype friend raised their hand yet?
Not yet. Nobody's raised their hand that's in the queue. We got a Skype member, we got Cinnamon, and we got Suzette, and our Robert, Robette, because sometimes they share the phone. But anyway, yeah, so nobody's raising their hand right now. So feel free to press 1, you guys. Skype number, Cinnamon, Robette, press 1 if you want to join the conversation.
Well, the way you can tell who it is if they're talking in all caps, it's generally Robert.
Yeah, that's true. But I can't tell which one it is on the switchboard, though, because sometimes they hand the phone to each other. I just recognize the number. Suzette in the chat, busted. That's funny. Y'all are funny. But yeah, that reminds me, you know, I probably should unmute everybody here shortly too, because there's about 18 minutes left before the switchboard will shut down. And so anybody that's on, maybe in about 10 minutes or so, I'll announce and just unmute everybody. You guys can all stay muted on your end, type of thing. Don't want to do it quite yet, but maybe I'll do that in a few minutes. Unless people are going to make their way over to Ron Rex's show.
Is Ron Rex doing a show?
He's doing a show, or at least he was. Let's see if he's still on. I just refreshed. Shows 1 hour, 16 minutes remaining for Ron's show.
Oh, okay.
He titled it, Someone Has Stolen My Gas Can. Apparently there's a big crisis.
No, it's not that. You didn't see the story about the guy who lit himself on fire outside of the Trump trial, did you?
Oh, that's what he's referring to. Yeah. I did see something about that, but I haven't really looked at it. Like, what's the deal with that? Like, what? What's the story?
He's just
I could pull up the news article
Democrat.
About it. I saw it, but I didn't really, like, look at it.
Democrat. Yeah. He's just another crazy-ass Democrat.
Oh, wonderful.
Oh,
wonderful.
Yeah.
Let me see. I know I posted it. I just got to scroll. I posted a lot of stuff. It's like it always seems like the later part of the week, like Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, like all of a sudden, like, hey, there's a whole bunch of shit hitting the fan, you know, like every weekend I'm like, oh my God, like there's this and then there's that, which I have some stuff for Boyd. Maybe I'll talk about it on my show on Sunday. Alaska related news. Let's see. I'm trying to go down and see. Where's the story of the dude lighting himself on fire?
Yeah, Fox
oh, yeah,
had
here
a little
we go.
Trouble.
Okay.
Fox
here
had
we
some
go.
Trouble.
Trump's hush money trial. A man set himself ablaze outside of former President Donald Trump's hush money trial on Friday in New York City. Friday marks the fourth day of the trial where alternate jurors were selected. Two jurors were dismissed on Thursday. The man who set himself on fire was reportedly inside the designated area for protesters outside of the courthouse. According to the Associated Press, emergency crews took the man away on a stretcher after putting out the fire. And that's all that's said about it in this Just the News. And there's a link to a Twitter post that has been removed for some reason. That's interesting. So what are y'all hearing about that? Who is this guy? What happened? What's up?
I haven't heard anything on it, but I watched it live on the TV. I happen to have Fox News on, and they were at the courtroom, talking about the stuff, and then all of a sudden there was a fire, and the reporter told the guy to turn the camera around, and he got the camera turned around to see the fire, and then the reporter saw that it was some guy inside the fire, and he told him to turn it away from the fire. And that's about all I really know. The reporter, they a lot of people got over there and got him put out, pretty quick. And then I remember the reporter, saying he was actually seeing the guy moving his arms and stuff, so he was still alive. And the last I heard was that he was in Columbia Hospital Burn Center in critical condition. Now, that's a guy who's going to be really pissed off and probably wanting to sue a whole bunch of other people, because he's going to be burnt all over his body. He's going to be burned, beyond recognition and shit, and in pain for the rest of his life. And I would have to say that after they get him all healed up and everything and get him out of the hospital, which will probably be, he'll probably be in the hospital for at least 9 months before he's released. And then he'll be in surgery for years after that, with skin grafts and stuff. So, he's probably going to off himself eventually.
Yeah.
I mean, but what is, are there any reports of like the extent of his burns? I mean,
he's in Columbia Hospital in critical condition. He's most likely got third degree burns over, his whole body. He was completely engulfed in the flames.
Right. What they did happen.
Depending on what he had on for shoes, the soles of his feet may have survived without burns, but I don't know. You know?
Right. What they say happened is this guy...
Yeah, he definitely probably never anticipated actually coming out of it alive. And then if you get burned that badly all over your body, I wouldn't want to live it through it. I know I'd probably off myself the first chance I could fucking get.
What they say happened was he showed up with a sign that said, I have to go back and look at it, but the sign that said something, and then he had two or three cans of gas with him, you know, like cans of gas that you would have, that you would use to, like, fill up a lawnmower or something, right? You know, that type of stuff.
Yeah, and like one of those 5-gallon jugs or something, you know, those 5-gallon or so metal jugs
and
or something like that.
And what he did is he just took it and he just dumped it on himself. And he just lit himself on fire. That's what he did. He's a pretty nut job. No?
Did he yell anything? Is there any explanation as to what his fucking motive was? Like, why?
No. Not yet.
I've seen an article from, like, it's not the Babylon Bee, it's the friggin', what's that British paper?
Daily Mail?
Daily Mail. They talk about, you know, he's from St. Augustine, Florida. They gave his name. He talks about Trump and Biden being in cahoots, you know, in terms of working together and all that stuff. You know, he hates both Trump and Biden. He hates the Democrats and the Republicans. But, you know, he's a Bernie Sanders person, all right? You know, and all that stuff. So.
Bernie, yeah. He's feeling the burn, I can tell you that.
Really? Nice one, boy.
Hold that thought. Just to put it out there, Skype number and Cinnamon, you've been kicking back listening, but I want to remember to unmute you before I lose the ability to. I know the switchboard is going to shut down in a few minutes. So I'm giving you fair warning to mute yourself on your end, and you can still just continue to listen, but I want to unmute you in case you do decide that you want to speak up at some point, and my switchboard will shut down and I won't be able to. So here we go. I'm going to unmute you. 3, 2, 1. So you both are unmuted now. So we have Mike, Joe Gibson, Boyd, Skype number, myself, and Cinnamon are on the switchboard and unmuted. All right, continue, fellas.
Yeah, this guy, like I said, this guy is a friggin' nutbag. I don't want to say he deserves to be, you know, but the guy needs to, if they can get him, you know, all fixed up, he needs to be wearing a white coat and be taking Thorazine, you know.
Yeah, this guy needs to be under psychological evaluation for a very long time after this, for sure, if he doesn't find a way to off himself. You know, you got to be pretty committed. You got to be pretty committed to douse yourself in gasoline and light yourself on fire. which is why I'm wondering, like, you know, before somebody does that, if they're trying to make a point, if it were me, I would be screaming what my point is either before and during I douse myself with gas and before I lit the flame, you know what I mean? I would be making sure that everybody around me is hearing why, you know, hearing what I have to say, probably whipping out their phones and recording it so that everybody in the world would know why. You know, I wouldn't just, like, walk up and go, okay, no, I'm going to do it, you know, and not say anything. You know what I mean? Like, if you're trying to make a fucking point, you're going to say what your point is before you do something like that.
Maybe. But it's a wonder he didn't burn a few more people along with himself, because evidently he poured the shit over top of him. You know, he was in the protest area where, you know, outside the courthouse. So, you know, there was a bunch of people there. And I'm sure once he started pouring that gas, they scattered.
I know, I would. I'm not going to stand around like, yeah, I'm just going to stand here while this guy's pouring gasoline all over himself. You know, I'd be clearing the way as well. I'd be like, okay, get the fuck out of here.
Well, let me say this. He probably had four times the amount of flames going up than the Buddhist monk ever did.
Oh, God.
Yep.
The same thing about this, guys. There's a reason why, like, NASCAR wears these special suits when they're driving their cars. You know, they're made out of Nomex, which is a material that does not burn. Oh, it burns, but it keeps you protected from the flames, right? It's a flame retardant thing. And this guy decided not to wear any type of flame retardant clothing. He gets what he deserves.
Well, if you're gonna off yourself in the middle of flames like that, you wouldn't want to put on Nomex anyway.
Yeah, right.
That would defeat.
Yeah, you'd want to make it go as fast as possible. You know, nobody wants to, like, linger with their burning to death. You know, like,
yeah.
You're gonna try to make sure that it's quick.
Besides, one of the reasons why they do that in NASCAR is because when you get a fuel fire, you can't see the flames because of the fuel that they're using.
I'm looking at some of my old messages on my phone here. This is back a few months ago. You guys ever hear of... God.
What?
How much did this guy have to pay to fill those gas canisters? Because we know gas... This is New York, and we know... You know, it may be $3.85 here in Louisiana, but in New York State, it's what, $8, $6, whatever it is, to fill a 5 or 8 or 10 gallon can of gas. He spent a lot of money to fill those gas cans. I bet.
Small price.
Well, unless he filled it up before the whole Iran strike and the gas prices going back up. if he filled them up ahead of time and it was still cheap, or relatively cheap. Joe Gibson, what were you about to say? You were trying to talk. I want to give you the chance.
I just wanted to ask you, if anybody ever heard of a guy, James Freeman? He's got a review of the hospital tyrants taking the baby using law enforcement. Some baby was stolen or whatever. So anybody hear that name, James Freeman, by chance on the internet?
No.
Daryl McCain of Missouri.
This is sounding familiar. I might have heard something about it, but I'm not placing it.
All right. I just got a bunch of messages about it. That's all. I was just this, you know, stuff that I'm reading. There's a couple of months ago, but I'm just saying them. I just want to know if you guys knew those names. If not, then there's no point in going into the story, I guess.
Sure.
Well, unless it's an interesting story.
Well, I mean, it's not, you know, just the text messages that I got, you know, and stuff like that. But if you guys don't know them, then I was just wondering if you knew these people or not, you know? Or heard of them.
What, guys, the thing, you just mentioned that strike it with a ranch, somebody did. The thing with that strike, that was a proportional response. It really didn't do anything to Iran. It was a proportional response. If they really wanted to hit Iran and hit them good, they would have hit all their gas and oil things, you know, blew the crap out of that shit.
No,
then,
they're testing.
Oh,
they're
no,
testing.
They're not going to do that. They're not going to blow up. Let's completely thermite the hell out of their gold reserves and just melt it. Like, we would never do that. We would want to take that shit for ourselves. You know? Goddamn sure that the oil is safe.
No. That's the point. This was not, if you really wanted to teach them a lesson, you would tank their economy by blowing the hell out of their oil stuff, you know.
Eric Schmidt, Matt Thompson. It was a shooting. There was a shooting. Concerned citizen Matt Thompson. The shooting of Jeffrey Winehouse.
Mm-hmm.
You'll find out. Eric Schmidt tells him he works for the state. Anybody know about that situation? Josh Hawley?
I know. Josh Hawley's a senator.
Okay. Yeah, Attorney General's office. Yep. Okay. But these are just cases that were I'm sent, you know, and people were telling me stuff, you know what I mean? So, there was an excessive force case on a California Highway Patrol murdered a man under the color of law 2 weeks before George Floyd's death. So it was Josh Hawley's hometown person. I'm taking it. Yeah. So, you know, just saying this is just stuff that I'm, you know, just wondering if you guys heard of these cases. That's all.
No, not really.
If it's something in Missouri, maybe Ron knows.
Yeah.
Sure. But yeah, you know. I would assume that the next time Iran tries, or the Persians, or whatever you want to call them, try something like that, that's going to be what they're going to do, is they're going to hit their, you know, oil stuff.
Yeah, Iran will probably do it tomorrow on the Sabbath. They'll do it on the Sabbath.
From the reports that I've heard, what Israel took out was one of their air defense sites.
Yeah.
That was at a military base. That is probably one of the. Bases that protect their nuclear facilities.
Yeah.
They didn't hit the nuclear facilities, but they showed them they could take out the air defense system around that base.
Nope.
and then get to their nuclear facilities.
Yeah.
That's what Israel's target's going to be, is their nuclear site.
Yeah, when they do that, it's over.
Yeah.
And then they want
they're gonna
to
do it.
Prove to, they want to prove to Iran that they could strike them with impunity or immunity or whatever you want to call it. Where they could reach out and touch them to use the old AT&T thing.
Yeah, well, this is the start. This is huge, that what happened last night. They're downplaying it in the corporate media.
Oh,
so,
no.
You know.
Yeah. Yeah, you expect them to downplay it because, you know, again, here's the deal. We're paying Iran. Iran's paying Hamas. All right? They don't want... They're trying to protect the quote investment end quote we made in Iran. We quote made in Iran, right? You know, by giving
it's a new world order.
Yep,
it's all about the new world order. That's what it's about. They want you dead. They want 500,000 people on this planet. That's it. They want the rest of us dead.
Yep.
And they're going to get it, too. They're going to get their way.
And frankly, I like that guy you had on your show last night, but there's something that...
Adam?
Adam, I like him, but there's something that I just firmly disagree with him with. But,
what's that?
In terms of... what he said about rap and all that stuff, but I don't want to get into that.
Yeah, well, you have to understand his background. He got screwed over by the church really bad, so, you know, broke up his family. So, you know, that's why he has resentment towards that. That's why I don't argue with him about it, you know. Everyone has a reason sometimes why they say things, even if they're right or wrong, you know.
But
and I've known him for years.
What they're doing with the NWO, though, with the depopulation thing, is directly against is not biblical. God told Noah and them to be fruitful and multiply, right? He said it twice.
What do you mean?
He said it to Adam and Eve, and he said it to Noah and his kids and their wives. Be fruitful and multiply. So them trying to depopulate the world is not biblical.
Why not? It says Book of Revelation, 2/3 of the earth is going to be wiped out.
Well, that's a punishment thing. It's like what happened with Sodom and Gomorrah.
Yeah.
And the
well, that's what I'm saying.
The plane.
Yeah.
Yep.
You know, it's biblical. They're gonna wipe out. You know, during the tribulation, you know, the last half hour of the tribulation, it's gonna be hell on earth, man.
I mean, I stated the fact that what the Bible says, and I believe it's Psalms 102, where or is it Zechariah, whatever it was, that there's gonna be some kind of explosion where people are gonna be standing and their tongues are going to waste away in their mouths as they're standing there. Now, there's only one thing left, one thing other than something supernatural that can do that, right? And that's the bomb. That's it. So that tells you that at some point there's going to be some sort of nuclear explosion in the Middle East. You know?
Well, the end times, you know, is obviously a topic of interest today because a lot of things, well, at least, you know, many recently, you know, the recent events that have happened in the Middle East appear to be the fulfillment of, you know, biblical prophecy. That's obvious. I mean, the intensifying violence, political turmoil, and war in Israel, you know, has basically, you know, have many are scrutinizing now biblical prophecy, you know? And with the, or people that used to scrutinize them now all of a sudden are saying, "Whoa, wait a minute! They got renewed interest now because they're searching for correlations between current events and scripture predictions." you know, new social media platforms, religious congregations, you know, all these speculation individuals are grappling with the possibility that these events are this war in Israel is it, you know, these are signs of a divinely orchestrated thing that's going to happen right before our eyes. You know, the Bible lays out these events and stuff, you know, and perimeters, you know, that take place right in black and white, right, that were written thousands of years ago. So whether men are making it happen or not, it doesn't matter. It's happening, and it was written thousands of years ago. So, you know, is this Israel, is this war the sign of the end times? That's what everybody's asking, you know? So, you know, that's what everybody wants to know.
You know, when the apostles asked Jesus Christ, how will we know when it's time for your return? And he said, one of the things he said is, wars and rumors of wars. It's right there in red, right? Wars and rumors of wars. Well, here we go. We're having wars and rumors of wars now, right?
Yep. Yeah.
There you go. I mean,
there's a lot more other prophecies too. You got Ezekiel 34:13, where it says, I will bring them out from the nations and gather them from the countries, and I will bring them into their own land. I will pasture them on the mountains of Israel, in the ravines, and all the settlements in the land. And he did that in 1948. He brought them out from all around the world. You know, it became a nation again. You know, and that's what he was talking about. With the restoration of Israel as a nation, that it says, not a generation shall pass. And that's when the end will come. A generation in the Bible is 70 to 100 years, always. Mm-hmm. That's what a generation represents. So Gog and Magog, all right, in the book of Ezekiel, in the end days prophecies, explains, it says in Ezekiel 38:39, very clearly, Magog, to the north of Israel, invading Israel, you know, as it says, told that this country would form an alliance with Persia. Okay, who's Persia? Iran. There you go. Persia changed its name in 1935 to Iran. We know that. So you can't argue that, right? And Magog is what? We call modern-day Russia, right? One of the most prevalent calls toward prophetic signs. So, you know, the alliance between Iran and Russia, they're talking about it in the news today. I mean, come on. You can't deny it. I mean, so how, you know, so this is all written.
And then they also mention what they call the kings of the East in Revelation. Well, who's the kings of the East?
I don't know any kings in the East. What are we talking about there?
Loosely translated, that is kings of the rising sun. China.
Who's that?
China, Korea, Vietnam, Japan, you know, all those people. There's going to be two attacks, and one of them is going to come from the north, which is Russia, Turkey, you know, all those people. And then the other one's going to come across the dried-up Euphrates River through Iraq toward the west, right? So if you're coming across the Euphrates River,